Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to On the Time Lash, episode 43. I'm Ben.
I'm Mark, and can I just say it's very nice to be with you here again, Ben, and with you, the listeners. Yeah, I don't know why I felt like that. I felt like I'm just in a sort of general, lovely, warm radio address. Now that we've got some listeners.
We've got some, yeah.
I feel like we actually have listeners, so I feel like, you know...
We've got... This is the full whammy. We've got listeners, we've got news to talk about. This is great.
Good God.
And you can probably tell, it's a little noisier.
By our slightly hushed tones.
It's our hushed tones, and it's a little noisier than usual behind us, because we're actually filming... recording... live on location. It's called the Front Page.
Yes.
It was formerly the Horn Tavern, but basically it's the pub that you can see in the cliffhanger ending of the middle episodes of The Invasion. Mm-hmm. It is the pub in the background as a single file of Cybermen walk menacingly along the street. We're right next to St. Paul's.
And also, I mean, as we're going to be talking about the next Doctor in this episode, it's got quite a nice feel of like a sort of Victorian drinking den. A lovely little wooden booth.
Well, this was a favourite pub of Charles Dickens, according to the plaque on the wall.
Yeah.
This is, 43 episodes. This is the second only time that we've actually recorded an episode in a pub relevant or that you could see on screen.
And you're going to get at least two for the price of one in this episode, but we'll come to the second pub later.
So this is where we are. So basically, we're dead centre in Cybermen country.
Yes.
We're next to St. Paul's Cathedral. This pub was in The Invasion. And obviously, because it was The Invasion, that's where they did Dark Water, Death and I didn't realise this until I actually watched the episode again, but the Cyber King rises out of the Thames beside St. Paul's.
Yes.
So really, St. Paul's, this area, is the spiritual home of Cybermen in Doctor Who. So,
what was it you said to me on the way here, the Beaver King?
I don't know. Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, we're walking in the footsteps of the Cyber King. Because we also took a
You said it a bit grander. You were like, we're walking in the footsteps of Cyber Kings.
Walking.
And I was like, oh, that's lovely.
That is, that's the problem.
That's why we should have it on record at all times when we're together.
So here we are. So we're sitting in a little booth in the Front Page, the Horn Tavern.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to discuss the next Doctor. But before that...
There's a lot to get through.
I really liked your tweet of a couple of weeks back, which was, obviously we've had a companion announced.
Indeed.
We've had a genuine day where actual news about Doctor Who came out.
It was an actual bit of Doctor Who news day.
And new Doctor Who as well. We had the little mini-sode.
We did. That was kind of the nice thing about it, was that... Should we just go into this now?
Yes, let's do it. It's the main thing. We've got other things to talk about, but
I'm sure everybody's gagging
for our reaction.
I'm sure.
The announcement of Pearl Mackie as Asbill, or as Bill.
Yes.
However.
Or just the actress Pearl Mackie Asbill. Who knows?
I can't believe it genuinely. The announcement of the companion was nearly overshadowed by the fact that somebody...
About a typeface issue.
Yeah. There was a bit of a spacing issue.
Yes, there was. It's just like, oh, there's a new Doctor Who companion.
Yeah.
And you know what I've said on this podcast many times before, that I don't like to, I don't want us to be in the business of idle speculation.
Yes.
Okay? So, you know, when this announcement was made, I don't want us to be in the business of idle speculation.
Sure.
So the way I always saw as covering the announcement of a new companion would just be, this actress is the new companion. I don't know much about her, but I'm sure she's going to be great. However, what we got is, quite frankly, bizarre.
Yeah.
And I think worth unpacking and kind of discussing.
Okay.
So,
well, before we unpack what we actually got, we should discuss what we thought was going to happen.
Yes. So it was announced.
Yeah, it was announced that the companion was going to be unveiled.
There was an announcement of an announcement, which is a very modern thing to do.
But during it was all going to happen at the halftime mark of an FA Cup semi-final.
Yes,
I can't even remember who it was between.
Yeah.
But that was going to happen, and I think everybody thought, like it was the Super Bowl in America.
Yeah.
That the actress live herself was going to be, I don't know, brought out into the middle of the pitch.
Or somebody...
For the fans to then interact with her.
Well, so that's somebody that we follow on Twitter. I think it was...
For football fans?
The Doctor Who thing, and apologies if it wasn't, but I'm pretty sure it was him, that said, what exactly are they going to do? Are they going to just invite her onto the sofa to discuss the game so far? How is it going to happen? And it was very
odd. Or are they going to forego any match analysis of this FA Cup semi-final, and for that 15-20 minutes, hand it over to
Zoe Ball.
Sort of Claudia Winkleman or something like
One
that.
One Direction. But, yeah, it's bizarre, and like, my dad came to visit me that weekend. So he was like,
were they going to have like those old cine films of William Hartnell at like RAF air shows?
Oh, where he's waving from the...
Yeah, where they will then put the model of the TARDIS down on the grass and then will, under the cover of a tarpaulin, smuggle Peter Capaldi and Pearl Mackie into the TARDIS for them to then come out of it in a big reveal as if the Doctor and companion had just landed.
Perhaps. Well, my dad came to visit, right?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, listen, like, I'd quite like to be able to watch the football on Saturday. Now, normally I'd be like, well, Father, that's very antisocial of you to come here to see me.
Visit your
son. And
then
just want to watch football when you know I'm not really that interested. However, I had some work I needed to do.
Yeah.
And also I knew this was happening. So I was like, yeah, no problem. So we decamped to the pub. I set up with my laptop, did some work. And I was sort of poised for the announcement. But yeah. I was explaining to him what was, like, you know, this was going to happen.
Yeah.
He goes, what do you mean they're going to announce the new Doctor Who? Because he likes Doctor Who.
Yeah,
what do you mean they're going to announce the new companion during halftime?
Yeah.
I was like, well, I don't really know, to be honest. I just know that's what's going to happen. He goes, it's like, Peter Capaldi going to, like, get back in the tank and ride that into the centre circle and then sort of go, please welcome the new Doctor Who companion? I was like, I hope so, but I don't think so.
I find it so strange. I think you said this, that if you were to put together a Venn diagram of Doctor Who fans and football fans, it wouldn't be a Venn diagram, it would be two separate circles hovering nowhere near each other.
I mean, there is crossover, there's certainly crossover, but the thing is...
Can you imagine if you interrupted that halfway through, like you took a break during Day of the Doctor to announce to football fans how, I don't know, Blackburn...
Transfer window.
Yeah, transfer window, how Blackburn versus Tranmere Rovers was going.
Yeah, very odd. But so obviously what we get is a halftime analysis. Now keep in mind I'm watching this in a quite a busy Yates's because it was the only pub we could find in High Wycombe that was showing the football and that also had Wi-Fi.
Okay.
Which I needed to do.
So you could watch the thing and be sarcastic on the internet, is it?
No, my second job does require me to use the internet. However, that was also a consideration as well.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, or being able to access.
My third job of being a Doctor Who, well, it's not really a job, but, you know, of being a Doctor Who, a sarcastic Doctor Who fan on Twitter.
Or to be able to access the sarcasm of others, say Gareth Roberts. Who in these situations is absolutely priceless.
Indispensable, I would argue. Because I don't always agree with him, but I like having him
there.
God,
he's a showman. But yeah, so that's what we thought we were going to get, but what turned out, which we should have known better, was that we had a little self-contained Doctor Who scene, Doctor Who episode.
Which is possibly a new... Actually, sorry, before we get to that, actually, on the subject of being sarcastic about it and on being negative about it, which I don't think anybody... Although I said this to my friend Leo, and I was like, is anybody really being, like, properly negative about it? And he went... Let's be honest, probably yes. For Doctor Who fans. Of course there'll be something
else. The moment it was spelled as Bill at the end, there must have been half of the internet just went, fucking yes. Now we've got something to mock.
Well, there was this kind of notion that people were really angry that they would have to watch the football. I said, well, no, you don't.
Well, you don't have to be
It will be immediately on the iPlayer. So if you really want to, you can just sit by your computer and then around the halftime mark, just go on the BBC website and go, oh, there it is, press play. But from what I gather from the most recent Doctor Who magazine, this was a plan not actually by the Doctor Who production office, it was a plan by the... I don't understand how the BBC works these days, because
sure.
they don't have like a controller of BBC One anymore, they have like a controller of drama,
right.
and a controller of comedy, and all this kind of thing. It's kind of this weird... That's okay. a discussion for a completely different thing. But it was the idea of this sort of the head of drama at the BBC
yeah.
to do it during this football game,
sure.
sort of like give it this big position. And Edward Russell, the sort of brand manager for Doctor Who, was like, if you see any Doctor Who fans moaning about, you know, the announcement of the new Doctor Who companion during the football, just remember that their small little cult show has the most watched spot on BBC One this week,
yeah,
or this spring or something. And I was like, right, fair enough, right, yes, it is good publicity. However, it's not really, because the people that were always going to watch that
yeah.
have watched it,
sure.
and they've taken in that information. The people that weren't going to watch that, so either people that don't watch football,
yeah.
or people that watch football. The people that were watching football, and I saw this firsthand because I was, like I say, I was in a pub full of football fans watching the game.
Yeah.
We're just talking amongst themselves as you do at half times in a football game.
Yeah.
You talk about the game, or you just talk about your general life stuff. You're taking that 15 minutes to just enjoy the company of the people you're with
yeah.
before then going back to watching yeah. what you came here to
go
watch.
For a wee or something.
Yeah.
Get
all these
pie.
Things. Nobody was paying attention other than me and my dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even he was a bit like, what's happening? I don't really understand. Is this
yeah.
Doctor Who?
Yeah.
Is this a bit of Doctor Who? I thought it wasn't back until next
what's
year.
What's all the background that I need to know about this
yeah.
thing?
So, I understand the hey, isn't it great? It's got this slot.
Yeah.
But really, the only people that were really taking note of that were Doctor Who fans. And then the people that wouldn't have normally taken note of it saw it in the papers the
yeah.
next day.
And it's not really like Doctor Who fans were made to feel particularly welcome. Gary Lineker seemed so
bemused,
unbothered about the introduction of
the
thing. It was
done
so low key, and then afterwards, when it cut back to him, we kind of had this, this look on his face like, what was that? Okay, it doesn't matter, whatever, back to football.
Yeah, back to the football.
And then there was this brief moment where they cut to somebody at the pitch side interviewing a manager.
Yeah.
And he started the interview, then started laughing as if they both were poised for the interview whilst
yeah.
the episode was going out, going, what is this? Why is this here?
Yeah.
This is why is Doctor Who encroaching on adult football territory?
Yeah, it's very
it seemed there was an underlying sense of mockery after it had been broadcast.
Yeah. But the thing is, because it was such a bizarre way to do it.
Well,
you know?
Particularly since, let's be honest, nobody knows. Like, if it was a very well known.
Well, that was the other
person,
argument as well.
Somebody
like, well,
who was
maybe
gonna,
it's
yeah, somebody who was going to unify a country.
Yeah,
I don't mean that in that way. But you know,
the
like
Queen?
Somebody. No. But you know, like that kind of way where, like, when Peter Capaldi was unveiled, like, they
that
probably
was a
pulled
big
out
thing,
all the
yeah.
stops because there's a lot of individual little Peter Capaldi fan bases
absolutely.
Brought together.
Oh, I remember that.
I remember
the day after that, loads of people who are friends of mine that are not Doctor Who fans were
yeah.
like, oh my god, that's amazing, that's so good, right? And I was like, yeah, I'm really excited
yeah.
about it.
But what we found here is that we had a situation where Doctor Who fans were going, I'm going to reserve judgment.
Yes.
And all the football fans
really?
Were going, who the fuck is this?
Yeah. That was my dad's response. He's like, who's that?
Who TF is this?
So we've been a bit negative, and you know,
it's not negativity, it's just sheer bemusement at the little roadshow that happened. But moving all that aside,
I suppose it's what happens when you make an announcement in a year where there's no Doctor Who.
Yes, yeah,
so what
yeah.
you get is, and there was like one little thing where I was just like, oh, actually, do you know what's kind of nice is that I couldn't hear any of the dialogue.
Yeah,
I just saw like the Doctor and Bill or
yeah.
Asbill or Pearl
yeah,
Mackie,
Asbill or whatever, Pearl Mackie, yes.
Talking about something and then being chased by a Dalek. I was like, oh, well, this looks all quite exciting.
Yeah.
And I was, it was only about like a couple hours later that it hit me. I was like, ooh, I've got like a new bit of Doctor Who to watch
yeah.
when I get home. That's kind of nice, actually. That's
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
like a nice little thing.
So getting on the actual thing. Firstly, under no illusion that she actually listens to this.
Yes.
But we're going to go ahead and do it and offer our congratulations to Pearl Mackie.
Sure.
Welcome to the world of Doctor Who.
Yes.
And I don't know, from what I saw, I'm really looking forward to it.
I think it's going to be
really
good. I think that, I mean, there was loads of, I don't know, sometimes I think you need to kind of just take a step back. There was a lot of people on Twitter going, oh, it's very dangerous to start slagging off the Daleks, you know, it undermines them as characters, blah, blah, blah. I was like, yeah, but I don't read that as her thinking. I read that as somebody who's a bit frightened and as a character trait uses humour to kind of diffuse the situation and to cope with the situation. That's how I was reading that, because you still had the Doctor going, these things are pretty terrifying though.
Well, what I loved about that scene is that, well, 54 years into the history of Doctor Who, and there's a whole little sketch there of a completely new way of thinking about the Daleks and writing about the Daleks.
It's absolutely.
Like, they're monsters that still allow a freshness of interpretation in the writing and how a character would perceive them. And all of these, I mean, you know, they do look absurd. They look absurd. They do absolutely look absurd. But we're so desensitized to them, and we're only aware of how people react to them, how they've been in episodes. We do see them as the killers. Mm-hmm. Somebody just encounters that. Just one of those trundling down the corridors. Yeah. They would rightly think they've walked into a Spike Milligan sketch or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I think that scene was perfect. I mean, I know they're saying it's a scene from a future episode. I don't know.
I hope it isn't. I hope it is what it. I mean,
yeah, it would be quite nice to just have like a kind of.
I mean, it doesn't look like anything other than what it probably is, which is like the couple of scenes that she was given
for the audition. I think that is what it was. Yeah. It was written for the audition. So I saw that, and when I actually watched it properly, I was like, oh, cool, this is just like a little sketch.
Yeah.
But then there seems to now be this kind of thing that, because the way it's built on the iPlayer, it's all a scene from a future episode.
Right. Okay.
So I was like, oh, all right.
Okay, because I'd heard people talking about that on Twitter. Yeah. I didn't know if there was any official BBC acknowledgement.
The thing I read, it's called like Friends from the Future, clip, and then it says a scene from a future episode introducing the new companion. Fair enough. I'm sure, you know. Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I mean, looking at it, what do we think? What do we think of Pelleki?
Well, it seems, in terms of the way she's dressed, that she's from the past. Like the recent past, like the 80s or the 90s. I know I don't like doing idle speculation, but I think that's a fair enough thing to say.
People go, oh, she's from the 80s or from the 90s. No, she's not. She's obviously from... Both of us now living in London. She's obviously from Dalston,
or
Camden, or some. That's exactly. She's probably from the past. Yeah. No, she's probably a fucking hipster from Camden or Dalston or something. It's just because she's got a very obvious London East End accent to her. You know.
True. She's probably been
whisked away, whisked away from a night out at the Dolphin in Dalston by the Dolphin.
Or a cereal cafe in Britain.
I reckon she's probably a contemporary companion.
Okay, well, we'll find out next year, because it does seem to suggest the scene that we're not going to have the new companion at Christmas, which I was kind of hoping we would. Which actually, I did read somebody kind of saying that maybe this is where the Raki Takra rumour had come from.
Okay,
That maybe she's actually in the Christmas special.
Christmas companion, yeah.
But, you know, fine. But no, it's. Yeah, good. Yeah. It's a new Doctor Who companion. They don't seem terrible.
Yeah. I mean, there isn't much you can really say about it. For that small amount of time, I think the script was funny. I certainly really laughed at a lot of stuff in there.
The thing about Two Plungers was pretty funny.
Two Plungers was funny. Fat, though. I thought it was great. I thought they exterminate rather than kill. Why don't I just say kill? Or do you want them to save time?
Yeah.
I thought that was a great interaction. I don't know. I mean, I really liked it. I think the only not infuriating, that's the wrong word, but I think the only kind of irking thing about the whole thing is that because she's so much of an unknown, they're... Right, we don't really get a sense of what she's going to be like as a companion.
I think that's good.
But what we then can't do is go and find other things that she's been in television and watch them and try and get a sense. First, when Matt Smith was cast, he was a kind of relative unknown, but there was a number of things that were being broadcast at the time.
I remember that at the time.
You could go and watch, and you could go and see what he would be like. Capaldi, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. Tennant as well, even at that point. You had Blackpool, you had...
I can't really remember Jenna Coleman.
She'd been in Emmerdale, and she'd done a few stun room at the top,
yeah,
I think.
There was enough stuff that you could like toggle to YouTube and Google it and all that kind of stuff. But with Pal Mackey, there's a stage actress, and it was only in the last couple of days that like one other thing that she's ever filmed, which is like a little comedy sketch,
right?
For like a dating website or something like that. She's very good in it. She's very funny. It's obviously she's got good comedy chops and stuff. But it's like there was a kind of who. I want to go.
But do you know what, though? That's kind of. Isn't that kind of.
She's
what it was
so
like
much of an unknown.
In the past? Like, you know, Tom Baker, granted he'd done a couple of films.
Yeah.
But to the general audience at home.
Yeah. Don't know.
And it works fine for him.
Yeah.
And I think now, like, it's quite funny.
But we're talking about an age now where we can indulge.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. And so that feels really weird to us now because of the way we live now.
Yeah.
We're like, you go, oh, I wonder what this person's done. Yeah. And you're like two clicks away from finding, you know.
Because something like that sets you up wanting a fix of that actor.
Yes.
Find out more about them, what they're up to. Really, the only thing you can do is, I don't know, shell out £50 to go and see the curious incident of the dog in the
Which
mouth.
I have seen, but I don't know if she was in the version that I saw, because it was only last year that I saw it.
Right. I think there's like a 6-month rotation.
Yeah.
I would also, I don't know, but I would be surprised if she's still in it now. I reckon the moment they make that,
she's still be in it.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. But, yeah, I might go and look back at the Edinburgh cast from when it was touring and see if she was on the touring cast. I think she's just in the West End cast.
Yeah, I think it's just the West End, yeah.
But, yeah. But that's the only... And you should go and see Curious Incident of the Dog in the Red Hood if you haven't, because it is quite good. It's quite an impressive production. The acting...
No point in that.
The part I saw, but, you know.
Because it was the touring production, not...
But in terms of the actual, you know, technical side of it, it's great.
So there we are. So, I mean, you know, I think she seems promising.
Yes, yeah. Brian Minchin mentions it in the magazine that, you know, it does kind of give a new... There feels that there's a new dynamic. And I do... You get a little...
She's the same. She's as tall as Capaldi. Is that the first time we've ever had Doctor and Companion of same height?
Is that not maybe just because of her hair?
Because of the hair.
They've actually both got quite tall hair.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
And actually, do you know what? I know it's a really weird little thing, but I find it really great to see... Because, I mean, the hoodie and the stuff like that, not as big a fan. I like the kind of, like, the crisp, kind of really nice velvet jacket in the... You know, I like that as a look for the 12th Doctor, so I hope that remains.
I like it the other way.
Oh, do you?
I love these rock star look.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's going to be a curious next couple of months, loads of months.
Well, yeah, but they are filming. We're in May now, so they're filming the Christmas special quite soon. Probably, we might get.
We're going to get a little
something.
Yeah, but we're not going to see Pearl Mackey for at least a year.
Yeah.
It'll be an exciting year, but. But what tides us over for that year? Well, one of the things that we've just done...
Oh, good line.
..is Mark and I are in the Horn Tavern here, supping pints after...
How you've just recapped, as if people... I don't know,
maybe...
Like, come into this halfway, like a radio programme, where it's on in the background and then
it's more to give me
sit down and get
material to edit with, which we're just going to be doing. But yeah, we've come from the Cartoon Museum in central London, where there was the big Target exhibition of artwork. Which seems like it was an official thing, because it was the brainchild of Edward Russell, the brand manager for Doctor
Who. And it's been promoted much like an official thing. Yeah. Mark Gatiss was on front row.
Yeah. So it's only been open for a weekend, so maybe about day five of the exhibition.
And open on Thursday night, was it?
Yeah, and it only runs for another 10 days or something for this. Closes on the 11th of May.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, it was a big, so like they had the opening in the Cartoon Museum. And Capaldi, Mark Gatiss, Stephen Moffat,
Terence Dicks,
as well as the artists, most prominently Chris Achilleos, were at the Cartoon Museum. And it's an exhibition of the various front covers of the original artworks, the various front covers.
Not just books and
it's
cases.
Not just a collection of books, but the Target novelisations, which I think if you're a Doctor Who fan, you're well aware of how important Target and its legacy was from 1965, I think, was the first one published all the way to midnight.
Yeah, the David Whittaker novelisation of the Daleks, wasn't it? Was it David Whittaker?
Sure was, David Whittaker, because he did the whole new introduction of how, like, he completely disregarded an unearthly child.
Mm.
So that in his novelisation...
Yeah, they find it on one of the Heaths or something.
So it's a completely... There's a little story to itself, a little origin story completely to itself. But yeah, so we went along, and I don't know what to make of it. My initial thought is that it's nowhere near as big as I thought the hype made it out to be. I thought it was going to be, there was all going to be a lot more than there actually was.
Yeah. I mean, there's, what, 30 pieces of work?
There's 30 pieces, but it's... So it's... Carter Museum's on two levels.
Yes.
It's on the upper level. But by upper level, what they mean is that it's just off to the side of a kind of stairwell.
Yeah.
So it's like half of a... It's a very, very small... Sorry, you can probably get a lot of excited Italians sitting in the
Spanish
booth, or Spanish in the booth behind us, ladies and gentlemen, and Mark is trying to shoot them a look of annoyance while
keep
he very...
We're trying to record Doctor Who podcast.
While he very loudly talks about Doctor Who in his booth. But that aside, what is curated is excellent.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, I think what is sometimes easy to forget is that... Well, I don't know. Maybe not easy to forget, but I mean, those covers are wonderful
sure.
pieces,
yeah.
And they are as important to Doctor Who and to how Doctor Who's been remembered and how Doctor Who's been kept alive.
Yeah.
And also, just the imagery of those things is really important to how we remember it.
Yeah.
Where was I going with that? But yeah, so it's really nice to see them presented as they are, which are pieces of art.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can see the brushstrokes, you can see just how vibrant some of the colours are. Like, I was saying that to you when we saw the Death of Daleks cover. Is that, yeah, it's great to see that book cover, but, you know, that book cover's maybe your copy's maybe a bit battered or a bit faded now. So to see it in this sort of vibrant blue and orange, and it's great.
It's also without any of the lettering.
Yes, so it's just like...
Just the original cover art, before any reviews or titles or authors were put onto the top of it. So, yeah, so for instance, that one we're talking about, The Death of Daleks.
Which is really great.
You know, they unfortunately hover the title and the Doctor Who logo on top of the colourful explosion coming out of the Dalek's head. For the first time now, you get to see the Dalek's head fully exploding with nothing in the way.
Which is really good. I mean, yeah, and so for that, I loved it. I thought it was a really great thing. And I think, I mean, in terms of the wider impact, I think it's great that somewhere like the Cartoon Museum and on Little Russell Street, if you are in London listening to this and you don't know about it, I think it's really great that, because an exhibition like this will pull in people that would not necessarily have visited that museum, and it will keep that place going. And I think in a period where funding and stuff like that to places like the Cartoon Museum, you know, places that aren't these sort of big show-stopping attractions.
Yeah, it's not the V&A.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not the British Museum, not which British is like Museum. Just around the corner.
It is, yeah. You know, then that's great, and I'm wholeheartedly behind it.
Yeah.
From a Doctor Who fan point of view, obviously, you kind of want more. You would, just because you've got that innate need to just, I'd love to see bit more art.
I think, okay, we're in a period where there's no Doctor Who happening.
Yeah.
But we are still spoiled.
Yeah.
And coming off the back of a couple of years where there's been these massive XL Centre conventions, this very much feels like this little Target exhibition at the Cartoon Museum very much feels like those small pre-2005 exhibits that would happen in like provincial art centres and town halls and all that kind of stuff. We've been to a couple.
I'm sure the listeners at home have been to those as well.
Our friend Colin Young was in Scotland. He had the kind of the monopoly in Scotland of exhibiting a lot of the stuff that he had in, like, I don't know, the town centre of the town hall of Motherwell or some place like that. And, you know, you had to suffer a day in Motherwell to go and see these beautifully curated, the very small little fan exhibitions. Yeah. So this is what it reminds me of.
Yeah, and you know, that might sound like a criticism,
it's not. Like I started off by saying, it's very small. And it's not, it's a perfect size, because ultimately it's the art that speaks for itself.
Yes,
you might not be walking or covering a great distance in a building.
Yeah.
You're completely immersed in these 30 pieces of art. And I dare you to go to this thing and not stand in front of at least one and just get an absolute melting tingle inside of you, which immediately you want to run home and pick up a DVD or pick up the Target novelisation and read Doctor Who. And It's a great exhibition. There were some things I was hoping would be there and were not.
Mm-hmm. The original Three Doctors artwork, I was really looking, you know, that kind of Fantastic Four ripoff.
Yeah, so there's the more popular, popularly known cover, mm-hmm. which is Omega and his massive monster hands zapping the three Doctors below. What else did I want to see? I mean, a lot of the Target novelizations I have are actually of later.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, like all the newer kind of cover ones, the ones from the 80s, the McCoys and the Colin Bakers. I thought there would be some stuff from there. But it all seemed resolutely, really, it was John Perley, Tom Baker covers.
But then I think that's because they were going for a certain... I mean, in terms of curation, I think they were going for... very much for those book covers, which are like paintings, like pieces of art. Yeah. Because a lot of the time, I mean, I remember there's a copy of Earthshock that I remember my primary school library having when I was first kind of getting into Doctor Who. And the cover of that was just Peter Davison with a gun.
Kneeling down with a gun.
And that gives you a very different image of Doctor Who from what you then later come to appreciate Doctor Who actually is.
Yeah.
So, like, they were going for stuff that was. You know, that you could put in a museum and you could present as art. And I think, sadly, a lot of those... although that being said, I mean, the Greatest Show in the Galaxy. Although I think there was a Virgin release.
Yeah, it was. Okay.
But the cover of that's a really beautiful...
Yeah.
And also, like, actually, when Virgin got the license and they did sort of reprints of, like, sort of Power of the Daleks, I think they did. They did a few... books. Some of those are really great as well, but obviously there's focusing specifically on that Target period. And so obviously you're going to have a proliferation of Tom Baker, John Pertwee, Patrick Troughton.
Sure.
But yes, it was really lovely to see.
Yeah, it was a great exhibition. It was a very worthwhile museum. I would say again, go into it with the right attitude. Check your enormous show-stopping Doctor Who attitude, and it is a very small, intimate, meaningful affair.
Absolutely, and it's funny. I think, you know, it is so bizarre. Like, I mean, it's still bizarre to me. I mean, and it's been back now for 11 years. We've had Doctor Who in this kind of top position, you know, in pop culture. For 11 years, and it still feels strange to me. Like, I keep expecting, you know, stuff at the Target exhibition, that to be the biggest thing that there is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, the stuff we grew up with, these sort of small-scale exhibitions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's great to go back to that kind of...
That size of thing.
It's nice. You know, the people that we were there with... The mysterious barter aside.
We have to say it was also there was also the classic Who smell, which was you know, like, just these kind of lonely looking older guys letting off every now and again.
So that, but there was a couple in there, I think, just as we were leaving.
It was very hard to enjoy the web of fear image with the noxious smell.
It's come back round.
The noxious fog of shit in your nostrils. Don't get that out of the XL store.
No. There's quite good air conditioning there.
High ceilings.
Yeah.
High ceilings. So we're in a new phase. We're in the final phase of David Tennant's years as the Doctor, obviously. And thank you, everyone, for your mostly positive reaction to our epic two-part Journey's End Five Doctors podcast. We discussed that. It felt like an end. It felt like a big party then. Mm-hmm. But we've got some more David Tennant. But as we'll discuss, there's a weird pall of death over the specials.
Yeah.
Which starts here. Because
I think it starts. I wouldn't necessarily call it a pall of death for this one.
Yeah.
I think this does is it very much sort of playfully deals with the idea that we know he's leaving.
Yes.
And it's quite fun to play around with that for an episode.
Yeah. Because we are
I say for an episode for about 20 minutes and then
because we are in fact talking about the next Doctor.
Yes.
It's Christmas.
Christmas 2008.
It's the first of the specials that would see us through 2009.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. I mean, it does play with the idea because 25th of December 2008 is when this was broadcast. What, 10 days later did we find out it was Matt Smith?
3rd of January.
3rd of January.
Yeah.
We found out that Matt Smith was going to be the Doctor. And that David Morrissey was not going to be the Doctor.
Although we found that out quite soon into...
That's one of the things I want to talk about how quickly the idea that he may or may not be the Doctor is settled, and it's a no. He's not. But stats first. Okay, so the 25th of December 2008, that's when The Next Doctor was broadcast, which was written by Russell T. Davis and directed by Andy Goddard, broadcast between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m, and it was watched by 13.10 million people.
It's pretty good.
Do you remember at the time, Tennant leaving was massive.
It was a massive thing. The aptly enough, in the time in which we're talking about this, you know, it was announced during a big event.
Yeah.
An event perhaps more geared towards such an announcement, the
People
National Television
enjoyed.
Awards.
Yep.
But he announced he was going to be stepping down as the Doctor.
Yeah, so he won Best Dramatic Actor, or Best Actor in a Dramatic Presentation. And they went live on the National Television Awards that year. They went live to David Tennant, who was,
Stratford, wasn't he?
He was doing Hamlet.
Yeah.
Half-time.
Half-time. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
And didn't they have two Cybermen there as well?
No, I think they had... Did they not just have two military guards from the production or something just standing alongside them?
Something like that.
It was very odd.
It was in the reading that I did for this, it was very stage managed. It was called Operation Cobra, which was if he did win, that was when Tennant live, so there's no possibility of having to record a thing and the contents of it being leaked. He was going to live announce that he was going to step down from being the Doctor.
Yeah.
What they would have done if he had not won that award. So
probably just put out a press release.
Yeah. But so we
knew, and then it would have looked really petty. He didn't win. I'm leaving, so fuck you.
Yeah. Well, I'm obviously not wanted anymore. So we had the episode, and then very soon we found out that Matt Smith was going. The interesting thing about this is that when Tennant started making The Next Doctor, he himself wasn't so sure he was actually going to leave.
So of course, because this would have been in the can long before that.
Yes, well, there was the possibilities. Now, apparently, since when he started filming Smith and Jones, there was the agreement that he, Julie Gardner and Russell T were all going to leave at the same time.
Mm.
However, when he heard that Moffat was taking over, he wasn't so sure that he wanted to go. So he... when he started filming this, he wasn't sure he was actually going to step down. However, the day he made the decision that he was going to go was actually, bizarrely, it was the day that he filmed projecting the images of the other Doctors from the info stamp on the wall. Now, obviously, that's all done in post-production, so there's no way that Tennant is sitting there.
Yeah, looking, I want to join this now.
Yeah,
I want to be part of this.
But it was on, you know, in that day where he's explaining who he is as the Doctor.
Yeah.
That he makes the decision, and then that night has dinner with Stephen Moffat and Piers Wenger.
Piers Wenger. He's a patron of the NFTS.
He's not gonna do it anymore. There's an interesting chronology.
Yeah.
With the making and then the broadcast of this story.
And the general reception of it as well.
Which maybe explains a bit more why the Doctor is a little more, a little more peppy than he is in the specials that will follow this.
Yeah. And I think that's why this is actually possibly my favourite of the four specials, which I know is not a popular opinion. Because I get the sense that people don't like The Next Doctor, and we'll get to this when we'll do the first 5 decades poll in a second. I get the sense that people don't like this as much as I do.
We all know, right, I think as Doctor Who fans, we all know that we give Christmas specials far too hard a time.
Yeah.
And I think when you divorce it from the Christmas context and just watch them, like, in the middle of April for a podcast, there is a lot more enjoyment to be gotten from it.
Which isn't always the case for Christmas specials, because, like you say, they are for a specific audience. A Christmas
Yeah,
special.
Well, yes, yeah,
And I think you do have to keep that in mind when talking about it. And actually, funnily enough, the next Doctor I remember, after really disliking Voyage of the Damned the previous year, I remember going into the next Doctor, I was like, look, just, like, I know what the Christmas special is now.
Yeah.
It's not a new piece of Doctor.
It's not a mythology
heavy. It's fun for all the family. Go into it like that, and you'll really, I remember just absolutely loving it.
Yeah.
And then watching it again for this, just so... I just like a big grin on my face for the whole thing. It's just such a joy to watch.
Yeah. Okay, right, well, that's your opinion. In what esteem do you think that fandom has the next Doctor?
I think
from
probably,
the first 5 decades.
I think it's probably something like 152.
Oh, mate, you're 3 off there.
Was it right there?
It was 149. Between 148, Death to the Daleks, and 150, The Macra Terror.
Interesting.
All right, well, so where do we start? So there's loads of stuff in this.
Yeah,
there's loads of stuff. There's, oh my God, we've got the Cybermen. It's Christmas.
We've got one of the
few female baddies.
Yes,
who's played by Dervla Kerwin, who I would have liked to have seen, if not a companion, a doctor, perhaps. If we're straying into the territory, we very possibly will have a female doctor.
No, she's really good.
David Morrissey.
I mean, you know,
it's so packed.
I could spend an hour and a half just talking about how great David Morrissey is, to be honest.
I mean, David Morrissey, he's unfortunately, the way he plays it gives it away that he's not going to be a real doctor. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but he's playing it.
I think it is intentional in terms of the way it, because obviously it's written that he's just had this like undiluted hit of what the Doctor represents into his head, so that he plays it up very much as parody. But plays very much.
It's not so much as parody. It's more like he's playing it like the 70s and 80s Doctors. Like he's playing it, you know, like he is playing it. This is not my original observation, but it wasn't until I read the Time Team. You know, in Doctor Who magazine,
yes,
the Time Team looking at it, and it's like he plays it like Colin Baker's Doctor.
Really? You think?
Yeah, because he's big, he's verbose, he's a bit nicer, but he's quite gregarious. He's you know, as they pointed out, you never see him and Rosita really enjoying each other's company. They're always arguing in some way. Playing it like an amalgamation of the classic Doctors in terms of language, in terms of performance, which I quite like. But I mean, that does spell out that essentially what we've got is not the next Doctor. It's the ultimate Doctor Who fan.
Yes, it is who David Morrissey
is playing.
That is a good interpretation.
Yeah. But as an interpretation, that does make us think that is there a darker undercurrent to this story, which is what Russell T. Davis is saying, is stop filling your brain with this absolute nonsense and go out and face life, because life is ultimately more rewarding.
I think that's actually... No, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I don't think he would ever admit it, because he's, you know, a very positive person. But I do think, and certainly in... I think we talked about it last episode. There does, as we're going out, there is a dark undercurrent that kind of runs through a lot of Russell T's later stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the Donna's Fate, like something like Midnight, where, you know, it's just basically the absolute worst of humanity.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, you having a bit of a... Because, you know, again, you know, Jackson Lake seeks solace in being the Doctor because he has this terrible tragedy before them.
Yeah.
And it's an escape. And it's like, is that dealing with kind of... not in as deep a level as you would maybe get in if this was an episode in the run, rather than a Christmas special where everything's going to be fun and exciting and dramatic and show stopping. That if this was an episode placed within a series, maybe that would have been explored a bit further. This idea that, you know, he's escaping from something by being a hero because he couldn't be a hero and save his wife.
Yeah.
So what he's doing is he's mimicking this character that he's had injected into his head.
Yeah, like he's completely filled himself with all the facts and the figures. Basically, the cold, everything except the emotion that makes the thing real.
Yeah.
In order to completely escape from the terrible thing that's happened.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it kind of picks up from themes that were put forward in Love and Monsters.
Yes,
which is all of these people, you know, everyone that made up Linda, only really became fully fleshed, happy characters when they started meeting together.
Yeah.
And their little group became more than just talking about the Doctor. You know, like, they made their little band together and, you know, like they did all their other wee hobbies together and stuff.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about darkness, I mean, Miss Hartigan is probably the most overtly damaged baddie that we've ever encountered, really? I mean, I would think so.
Yeah.
Or at least damaged by incidents that, as an audience, we would recognisably wince at.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's obviously that she's been a victim of acute abuse of various sorts.
Mm-hmm.
So that when she's sitting as the Cyber King,
says
something like another man come to assert himself against me in the night, you just think, fucking hell.
Yeah.
I mean, Christmas Day, mate. Come on, keep it light.
But then I think that's maybe one of that. Well, I say maybe that is one of Russell T. Davies' strengths as a writer, is that he can do these kind of big blockbuster episodes of Doctor Who, but kind of seed in these darker themes, you know, because that is what is spurring her character on, is that, you know, she's somebody that's no longer going to be taking the abuse, the oppression, you know, and she's going to strike
it
on her own.
It's a complete revenge journey.
And actually, it's kind of, it's actually quite tragic in the fact that the Cybermen see this and manipulate this themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually what she... I mean, it is actually really horrible, her fate, really.
Yeah.
Because the Doctor obviously removes the thing and just allows her to see what she's allowed herself to become.
Yeah.
And essentially what she's allowed herself to become is, it's just another instance of her being abused or misled, or
she's the one who's now doing the most.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be now that you're saying that, it would be really interesting to have seen the scene where the Cybermen and Hartigan first make contact. How did that happen? Who zeroed in on the other as a means to an end?
Yeah,
you know, that would have been.
This is a really heavy start to the episode, isn't it?
Yeah, like this light from, considering the fact that it starts, the actual episode itself starts,
it's such a laugh,
with the most wondrous, joyous Christmassy opening.
But I think that is interesting, and I think what we'll come to talk about as we talk about the specials is that it really is, like, it would have been so easy for them to just be really lazy and just write Doctor Who 101, but they don't do that.
No.
I have my problems with Planet of the Dead, which we will discuss in more detail, but it never feels that they're resting on their laurels.
No.
They're always trying to do something. They're still trying to shift the show in a new direction.
Well, it's nice that they've tried to do something a bit meta.
Now
that they know that David Tennant may be going, this is certainly at least the end of an era for the writer and the producer. They've decided that they're toying with the idea again. This is what fascinates me, is that we're four or five years into Doctor Who coming back, and it's confident enough now that it's suggesting to an audience that it's going to majorly play with its continuity.
Yeah.
That it might actually introduce a new Doctor.
Before you see
the regeneration, but you might actually get to meet the Doctor before the regeneration.
Yeah.
And that such a thing so heavy in mythology, it has to be an incredibly confident show that can allow the general public, i.e. promoting speculation on, like, BBC News in the morning or something, that they might actually get to meet the new Doctor
in a weird, tiny, whiny way. It's the logical next step from that cliffhanger to Stolen Earth.
Yeah.
You know, that was... Because by that point, we all knew that David Tennant was leaving.
Yeah.
You know, what? Yeah. Hang on, this can't be happening.
So apparently, the big reaction that came. So apparently the reaction of "we don't want Tennant to go," of that little cliffhanger regeneration, was far more intense than Russell T. Davis ever thought. And he went, okay, well, this is an angle we can play with in the next couple of specials. we can really milk this out. We can really play with people's.
Yeah, I mean,
know.
I mean, the way that that episode was promoted. Like, I remember listening to the Toby Haydock Russell Petty interview, in which Toby Haydock's like, you know, this was. I remember running up to this. Like, this was the point at which, like, my friends and family seemed to know about Doctor Who more about Doctor Who than I did. Because they were like, oh, so David Morris is the new Doctor Who, isn't he? And he's well, no, he's not. He can't be. That's not what's going to happen. It'll be something else. But people genuinely believed that we were going to get a new Doctor Who.
Which is why it's so weird that it's so quickly dismissed within the episode that Morrissey is not the Doctor.
Not in the dialogue, but certainly in the way that they interact with each other. Yes,
you know with intent. I've got it actually noted down.
Is it the screwdriver?
You know, with the screwdriver scene comes,
which is just before the titles, isn't it?
So you don't on the titles. You don't linger so much, so that you can obviously
but
see.
Tennant's eyes draw you to it. I don't know if this is just me because it's like the third or fourth time I've seen it. But he does kind of clock that it's not.
Yeah. So I've got a note down here. So when the Doctor Jackson Lee, the other Doctor, is breaking into the dead Reverend's house, it's at the 10-minute mark that it's revealed that his sonic screwdriver is just a normal screwdriver, right? And then it's at the 15-minute mark where, after the Cybermen have chased him up the stairs and the Doctor listens to his heart.
Oh, yes,
That his look suggests this isn't the Doctor. Yeah. So it's 15 minutes in out of an hour show. And I think that's because this was written. So, like, the Cybermen were always supposed to be the main thing, right? But the hype, the promotion that surrounded Tennant going, always focused on David Morrissey.
Yeah.
And so, the fact that they give the game away so quickly is a remnant of the fact that the script was created outside the bubble of pressure and excitement.
That's the thing I always remember about this story, and what I love about it actually is that just really cheeky playfulness that they have with it.
Yeah.
And that the Cybermen are kind of, until the Cyber King.
Yeah.
They're really just playing second fiddle to this wonderful partnership of David Tennant and David Morrissey.
Even though the original idea for the story was purely about the Cybermen.
But and the thing is, that's a good idea because I mean, I think I love the idea, and I don't think it's realised as well as it could be.
Yeah.
But presumably because there's so many other elements of the story that are that the Cybermen in Victorian London—that's a great idea.
Yeah.
So that was the
genesis of the story. So, you know, basically halfway through the episode, the Cybermen attacking the funeral party. That was the original scene, the original notion in Russell T. Davis's head. Cybermen in snow.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to do something that was like in the 10th planet when you first see the Cybermen, they're coming out of the mist and the snow. And in fact, there is a great scene. The very first time you see the Cybermen approaching in that scene, it is through the mist and the snow. And the music sounds, so it's the normal Cybermen music, but there's the strains of the 10th Planet Cybermen music.
Yeah, true.
The thing used more popularly in Tomb of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
And also as the thing for the Yeti attacking.
Well, it's not actually, it was never actually composed, as far as I'm aware. I think it was stock music.
Oh, was it?
Because it's billed as, is it Space Adventure 3 and 4 or something like that.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Because there was a big soundtrack box set released at the 50th.
Yeah.
And I think it's on the Troughton disc. And I think part of it's on the Hartnell disc, part of it's on the Troughton disc. But it's like Space Adventure 1 and 2, Space Adventure 3 and 4. And 3 and 4 is the one where you're like, oh, that's the music of the Cybermen. And then the Yeti.
The music of the Cybermen.
So they've kind of just used some stock. And it's that wonderful thing about Doctor Who is that you use something.
Yes.
And then it just takes on this complete life of its own and becomes this big thing.
Yeah. Either way, you're right. The Cybermen are second fiddle.
Yeah.
Even though they are part of the original.
And it's the same, because the thing is, like I say, I mean, I think Cybermen of Victorian London, steampunk Cybermen, that's a great thing.
Yeah.
And what we sadly get is a shaggy black rug with a brass plate on it.
Yeah, the Cybermen.
I'd love to see those, like, proper brass, you know, pipe Cybermen. That would have been really cool.
So I know that on Facebook, one of our listeners, Jeff Waddle, has said, take out the cyber shades.
Yes.
And I don't know if I'm quite with him, because I think the idea of what a cyber shade is, like a converted
as an idea
bear or dog or cat or something like that, is amazing. What we get, you're right, is quite weird. I don't know what the rags thing is.
Yeah, because it doesn't really look like any animal. You know, the whole idea is that it's a converted animal.
If it looked like a panther, if it looked
like
a dog,
you would have been like, oh, wow,
a cyber bear or something like that, you know.
It's more like a cyber Taran wood beast.
Yes, it is, isn't it? A cyber Taran wood beast. It doesn't look like what it is, unfortunately, which is a guy in a lot of washing up.
Yeah, it's very odd. So should we talk about the Victorian setting?
Yeah, okay. So this is the first Christmas historical.
It's the first Christmas special that's not set on Earth. Not set on the contemporary Earth. And we've got Victorian London. And now watching it recently, I found it really, and maybe I've noticed this at the time, but whereas you've got like Victorian London is such a huge factor in Stephen Moffat's Doctor, not just the Paternoster gang, there's a few other like Crimson Horror, I know they're in it, but he kind of goes back to that.
This is set in 1851, and because of the Paternoster gang, the Doctor regularly returns to I think Paternoster gang is about 1890s, so it's not about like 34 years from that point,
So, whereas that, there's mood lighting, there's, you know, the way that Doctor is shot from the Matt Smith era onwards lends itself much better to that kind of, you know, lamplight and darkened streets and the fog and all that kind of. And even, actually, to be honest, I don't know why I'm saying that, because The Unquiet Dead, I think, is very atmospheric as well, because it takes place at night. There's this weird aesthetic to a lot of The Next Doctor, is that it feels very false. A lot of the daytime stuff. I mean, I think the graveyard thing is great. I think the scene towards the end where the kids are being sort of taken out to it. That's all really good, and sort of the scene with the all the night stuff I think works really well. But there's an odd moment at the start where David Tennant walks out the TARDIS and there's that kind of sweeping tracking shot around the market.
Where,
it feels like, oh, I'm just on a set that has been dressed to look like Victorian London. And I don't know if it's because of that kind of soap opera hyper realist style that a lot of that era of Doctor Who has, that basically when it tries to do period stuff during the daytime, it kind of looks as if they're trying to do period stuff during the daytime. And then also when it gets to the workhouse, it kind of shifts from that soap opera aesthetic to this kind of West End musical.
Yeah.
It's like Doctor Who! Exclamation mark. You know what I mean?
Do know what you mean. I do.
It's odd. I love this story very much, but it's kind of, it always seems really weird to me. Like, there's just something that really removes me from the story at those points.
Well, I mean, so the definite answer to that is that, you're right. It is a Christmas story which is filmed in the Victorian period, in the midst of summer, where they've had to put snow everywhere, they've had to dress everything, they've had to, you know, they've really had to go to town. Also, is it possible that this is the very last episode to be shot in standard definition? Everything after that point is high definition.
Yes, it is. But
so,
did they not upscale it or something for the Blu-ray?
They did upscale
it. You can't get it on Blu-ray.
But in terms of high def and standard def production, once you start filming in high def, everything's got to have a lot more care taken. You've got to add a lot more stuff to the background. You know, you basically got to up your production value.
It's not a huge issue, but I just think it's an interesting thing to talk about, just in terms of the differences
maybe
in style.
Maybe it is purely the fact that they shot it during the day. I always take my hat off to writers, producers that try to sell the idea that a big walking thing is a good invasionary tool. I mean, essentially the Cyber King is the Cybermen version of the AT-AT walkers from Empire Strikes Back. The fact that you have to physically move legs, you know, at one point 50% of your ship or whatever it is off the ground and can easily be pulled over and destroyed and all that kind of stuff. But Russell T. Davis did present this really great argument, which is that he said the reason the Cybermen look like Cybermen, that they look like men, is presumably because they have chosen to look like that.
Yeah. Yeah,
they somehow
they want to retain some sort of vestige of humanity.
Yeah, but more than that, if you look at how science is taking on now, people would download themselves or upload themselves, you know, rather than have technology to replace limbs and lungs and hearts and things like that. Now, if the Cybermen were created now, they would be like The Wire, say. They would be a downloadable thing. They might retain an image of humanity.
Or the Spoonheads or something.
Yeah, something like that. So they obviously, to some degree, within the cyber culture, worship the idea of the bipedal human animal. So that they also pointed out the fact that when you look back at Tomb of the Cybermen, the fact that this little cyber men that are the images that are around the cyber tombs.
Yes.
Like that image is obviously very important to them. So that's why they're invasionary tools. Like you said, if you saw the cyber ships would probably be in the shape of a man. Cyber cities on Mondas and Telos would probably be laid out in the shape of a man. So it would be a natural extension that they would have a ship that would be an enormous Cyberman. When you think about it, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Like, if you physically have a force that you construct yourself, why, instead of having loads of little individual warriors, just create a fuck-off big warrior that could stamp all over the enemy? It's a sound idea.
I like it. I'm amazed there was never a big sort of Cyber King playset. Or maybe there was, I don't know.
I think that was at the point where it was like, we'll be a bit more classy and reserved with what we're turning toys into.
A big Cyber King thing, that'd be cool as fuck. You just get kids like going, because it's supposed to be a ship, so it's supposed to be able to take off and fly.
A dreadnought class. That's one of those lines in the next Doctor where you just go, who are you talking to?
Yeah. Like people at home going, of course it is.
As if Jackson Lake's going, I thought it was Dreadnought class.
To be fair, Jackson Lake's probably got a better chance of understanding that than anybody else watching at home.
Yeah.
Because he is, you know, imbued with...
Yeah, but I mean, like, by that point, it's like when they're in the basement of his house going, oh, they probably stole the info stamps from the Daleks in the void. Like,
To right of course they did, I remember that at the time going, can he not just be like, the Cybermen.
Yeah.
It'll just be them.
It's because it is the alternative universe Cybermen. Yeah. I don't know. I quite like it. I get where some people seem to have an emotional disconnect with the ending of it. The Cyber King is maybe not the massive threat that they were hanging around waiting for.
Maybe, but I mean, I think a lot of people go, why has it not been mentioned?
So, well, it is. I mean, it just gets cleared up later on.
How many years have we been watching Doctor Who now where, you know, like, and how many more times do people have to directly turn to the camera and go,
it's a time thing.
Flexible, isn't it?
Time things. Well,
like, just because it's happening to me now, it doesn't necessarily mean that all the stuff that has really previously happened has been rewritten.
Yeah.
Because if you follow my life in continuous order, it's fine. Yeah. But if you start looking at it in terms of how history has changed, that's when it gets into problems.
I don't know, I find it perfectly fine.
I think it's fine.
Because I like the fact that they finally deliver on the idea of the steampunk Cyberman.
Yeah, yes,
which is,
yes.
Which is a giant thing, you know. Like,
it's got like big pistons and
Yeah, because they've been entirely created by, for some reason, an army of children. I can't imagine they get much work out of it.
I don't really understand that. I mean, I suppose it's because they've got like a workforce...
Sure, they have a workforce, but I mean, there were like adult workhouses that you could have done that.
I think, there was, wasn't there? Yeah.
The fact that they've had really weak. I mean, because we're talking about like Victorian times, like, none of these children are particularly healthy. Yeah.
No.
So you're taking like the very weakest workforce you possibly can have to build a Cyberman for you.
Well, I mean, a very weak workforce, they're essentially the cast of Oliver.
Well, yes, it is.
just get some West End kids.
Yeah, that's maybe where I kind of fall into incredulity with the episodes. And the fact that when it hits that proper Oliver element, like, for the point, this is the thing that typifies it for me, right? When Jackson Lake's son, Frederick.
Is just standing on a balcony.
No, but the way the wee boy looks, I mean, that doesn't even look like a wee boy. I mean, like, don't you think? Because he's blonde-haired, he's got chubby little freckly cheeks, he's got bigger eyelashes than George off a rainbow. Right? Doesn't it look like they haven't actually hired a child actor? Doesn't it look like the production team have got together and, like, literally created the most sympathetic child that they could audience? Because there's everything about... He looks like the kids that you get on, like, those 1970s paintings that are around your auntie's house.
Oh, the big eyes paintings,
Like, he doesn't look like a real kid. And all the other kids are just, like, so impossibly... cute and sympathetic.
And they're just kind of muddied up a bit.
They just look like the stage children. Like there's going to be a big musical number in The Cyber King.
Do you know?
Like The Cyber King and I or something like is what it's going to be.
In many ways, I wish there had been.
You know.
Because I don't know, I think I do genuinely believe that some of those scenes
towards the end. It's a hard knock life for us.
It's the closest Doctor Who has come to doing a stage musical.
Yes.
It is.
Because
that work, whatever the hell that is, the sort of constructing the Cyber King.
Yeah.
That does not look like any sort of viable engineering.
Well, so what it is the Torchwood hub redressed. The Torchwood hub, which so that was set up to be an all purpose, essentially. Has won the single stage.
Yeah, with a big red light on.
Yeah.
But it's so stagey. And, fine, cool. But, it's really funny just to watch it.
But that's where it starts moving from. It was when you look at the scene, the Cybermen in the graveyard.
Yeah.
And there's like a proper hardness.
There's a brutality
to it. Then you get into the Oliver bit. And you see Frederick Lake and these massive eyelashes, and then it just like starts hitting absolute melodrama.
Yeah.
You know, when like the Doctor goes up to rescue him, like, he slices a pulley rope and the counterweight flies down,
and then he flies
all the way. And you know, like he's only like a couple of feet up, but like the Doctor seems like he's flying.
Well, the thing is, the
properly Peter Pan.
Yeah, I mean they're going down that route though because like it's the end.
Yeah.
They're given 10 as many hero moments as they can fit into an episode.
Yeah.
So he's got that, but he's got the bit in the hot air balloon where he defeats the Cyber King, and he's just like, I'm just going to have a lovely little... And then, like, everybody down below is just like, hooray, hooray, you've saved Christmas. And he gets to kind of...
Bravo, sir. Yeah. Bravo.
And do you know what? Like, watching it in April, you know, 8 years after it aired... I was like, do you know what? This is just lovely. Yeah. This is just really.
But that is the thing. Like,
warm I don't care that it's all a bit of nonsense.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, do you know what? It's nice to watch a bit of Doctor Who that just has fun.
Yeah. Well, that is the thing. Like, it always seems to stay on the right side.
Yeah.
So that it's not irritating or mockable. It is. You catch sight of yourself on a reflective surface and you're smiling.
Yeah, and you go, God,
rather
right,
than scowling. And
because, I mean, the thing is that in lesser hands, this story of somebody who believes they're the Doctor, and sort of acts like this sort of caricature of the Doctor, this kind of amalgam of all the different Doctors, that could be like an absolute mess of self-referential, back-patting smug jokes, and it's never that. It's got this warmth and this heart to it, and it's probably a human story about what happens when somebody endures a tragedy and they want to escape from that.
Especially the same as Jackson Lane, but it's the same Miss Hart again.
She decides to go with the wrong side.
It's kind of like Star Trek conventions, and there'll be the people who dress like Captain Kirk and Captain Picard. It's because they've resolutely decided to fill their lives with the goodies.
Yeah.
But then there's like the people who dress and completely embrace the culture of the Klingons. The baddies is what they are. So you've got Jackson Lake, who's very much the Doctor. And you've got Miss Hartigan, who's going, well, I'm on the other side.
Yeah.
I'm going to be the Doctor and baddie. I'm the Cyberman. That's what I'm doing. That's how I'm filling... That's how I'm distracting myself from the abuse.
Yeah.
it's the culture of the Cyberman.
Definitely. And isn't that great? Isn't that great that, like, a light and fluffy Christmas special can have this, like, this little subtle undertone of like the things people do to deal with tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, should we start pulling it together?
Bring it in.
Let's pull it together. Okay, right, well, of all of the quite outstanding performances, who gets it?
Do you know... David Morrissey. I'm sorry, like, it's obvious, but I just think he's so great.
Yeah.
And I think, and I love his chemistry with Tennant. I think it's really fun to play with that idea of the Doctor as a companion to his future self that very quickly turns out it's not his future self.
I would have liked to have seen more of that.
Yeah,
I'd like to have seen more possibility that he was the Doctor.
Yeah. Because I think at this point I'd seen Blackpool and I was just like, oh, I'm so looking forward to seeing these two like working together again. And I think, I think David Morris is great. And I think I like him more as Jackson Lake.
Yeah.
Than I do as the Doctor.
Yeah.
I really love... can I go into my favourite scene?
You sure can.
Because my favourite scene is just the end. Just him in the TARDIS, getting to see the TARDIS properly, and then coming out and inviting the Doctor to Christmas dinner, and the Doctor goes, do you know what? Yes.
Yeah,
I will join you. And you just...
You just leave it...
with just this massive grin on your face and this really warm feeling in your heart.
Yeah.
And you go, yeah, that's Christmas Day. Yeah. That's what I want for my Christmas Day Doctor.
Yeah, I like that scene. It's going to be... Davla Kirwan has
she
a lot
is
of good
very
work,
good
but
well,
I think in terms of sheer joy, it is David Morrissey. And I think what I want to take away from this is the joy rather than the upset.
Yeah.
It's definitely David Morrissey. Yeah, you're right, that final scene. I don't know. I mean, I got such a thrill from seeing, for the first time, for the first time in the new series, seeing the old Doctor projected on the wall.
I can still remember
the thrill seeing Hartnell and then trying to go,
on Christmas Day, it was like the best present.
Yeah.
Because it was the first time. I mean,
wondering if they're going to include Paul McGann's Doctor in it.
He had sketches and stuff like that in the Journal of Impossible Things, but this was the first time.
Yeah.
In televised Doctor Who, that you had that thing that became like quite a routine thing in the 70s and 80s.
Every time the Daleks or the Cybermen wanted to find out if this was the Doctor,
they would just play
his head
the clips.
Yeah, like the first time it happens was Day of the Daleks.
Yes. And then it happens in Brain of Morbius and an Earthshock.
But like finally having the thrill of the series going.
Of this being,
I loved that. I don't know, I really liked the scene where the Doctor and Jackson kind of got to know each other when they were raiding around the ex-reverend's house before the Cybermen attacked them.
I like the sword fight.
Sword fight's quite good,
And also just the reveal of the TARDIS, I think it's just played brilliantly.
Yeah.
It's a hot air balloon.
Yeah, it was and a tethered aerial.
I can't remember.
Tethered aerial release developed in style.
That's it,
So that was there. That was there well in advance of totally and radically driving in space.
Which I also like very much.
There's a lot of great scenes. I don't know. Special mention, I suppose, we should go to Rosita.
Yes.
It would have been nice to have seen her in more episodes, doing more companion stuff. But, it is what it is, so... Well, that's the next Doctor. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it is definitely one of my very favourite Christmas specials.
I think so as well.
I
think so too. And, scenes-wise, I think actually the one I would like the best is the attack in the graveyard.
Of course, it's great.
Or actually... when they're leading the Cybermen are leading Miss Hartigan to become the Cyber King. I don't know, it's just the nuance of that, like when Hartigan puts her arm through the arm of the Cyber
leader. I love that.
But when
that's
the Cyber
great.
Leader says something like this has been designated a lie and like basically that this is your reward, your emotion, we need to get rid of all that. I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Yes.
There's no chance.
You can't even do the voice.
there's no chance that Cyberman's going, right, your emotion, we need to get rid of that. The cyber version of Gok Wan. I don't know. I don't remember being completely enamoured with him when I first saw it. Because again, the pressure on Christmas Doctor Who is ridiculous. But you're right. Watching it again, middle of April, it's you really see it again. You really appreciate it, and this I really appreciated.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I think that it had a lot more care and attention and hope than the Five Doctors ever even pretended to have. I'm still angry at the Five Doctors, and I look back at notes just now, and there are so many other things that I wanted to rant about. I mean... All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. And as you can tell, the soundscape, again, behind us has changed, because we've changed pub.
We have.
Right, so we're going to come clean beer. So what we wanted to do...
I just want to be clear that I was willing to lie to you all.
Okay. Now, I think we've built up trust.
Okay.
We need to be truthful with our listeners. We were going to go for the Coach and Horses in Soho. We were going to leave the Horn Tavern, front page, whatever it's called now.
Yeah.
Head for the Coach and Horses, and we did. But it was absolutely heaving.
Mm-hmm.
The Coach and Horses, obviously, because it was... It was both Tom Baker and John Hurt, favourite pub. If we're doing robot, we decided to pair a robot with an ex-doctor.
Which will explain why in a bit.
Sure, but, giant robots. that's what we're doing.
Okay.
So we thought we would move to the Coach and Horses, but it was heaving. So we've actually just come a little further down Greek Street, Soho, and we're at, as we said, an equally wonderful pub called the Pillars of Hercules, which has close connections with Charles Dickens.
Former Doctor Who guest.
Charles Dickens. Doctor Who's very own, so it still works.
It's fine.
But we're here to talk about Robot, the debut story of Mr. Thomas Baker.
Mr. Tom Baker.
What drinks have we got for this? Is it worth talking about that?
Well, we've got 2 pints of wine, haven't we?
Yes, we genuinely do. Well, if you don't believe us, we'll put photographic proof on Twitter for you. That was very expensive.
Favourite buy.
I think we should just go back to doing this
the good doctor.
In our own homes.
Where a pint of wine is a lot less expensive. Is that what you mean?
Not London prices. I've got some crisps. Robot. Let's talk about Robot.
Cool.
Start with the stats. Good pick. Another good comparison between Next Doctor and Robot.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was the 1974 Christmas Doctor Who.
Of course it is, yes.
It was broadcast between 28th of December 1974 and 18th of January 1975, between 5:30 and 6 o'clock, with an average... Basically, it was between 9 and 10 million people. The debut adventure for the Fourth Doctor. It's written by Terence Dix and directed by Christopher Barry. Produced by Barry Letts. Script edited by Robert Holmes, because there was that little
period
between the two productions, the two legendary productions.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Mark, Robot. Where do you think Robot?
Again, I think it's quite low down.
Of the Fourth Doctor legend, where do you think? I'll just have a sip from my genuine pint of wine.
I think that we're probably looking at maybe not really low down. I think it's probably higher than the Next Doctor.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with 127.
Okay. 116.
Okay. All right.
Between 150 Warriors Gates, 117 Modern Undead. Again, interesting company.
Interesting.
There.
Yeah. Interesting.
So why did we? Why did female villain giant robot?
Female villain giant robot. A new doctor.
We were originally going to go for Mark of the Rani.
Yeah, because it was like Victorian London and a female villain.
Yeah.
Well, the Victorian either.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right, a new doctor we've got to get acquainted with.
Yes.
And work out if he's for us or not.
Yes.
This is interesting. This is an interesting pick.
The reason we chose it, actually, we've kind of crowbarred in these other reasons to justify our decision, and it was so that we could record an episode of The Coach and Horses, which we've singularly failed to do.
Yeah.
But maybe another time.
I reckon it's one of those pubs we're going to have to hit it up at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Fine by me.
If we want
to. I usually finish work about 10, that's fine, yeah. No worries. On the night shift.
You should explain what you do.
No, I shouldn't.
What on earth are people thinking?
So that was one of the main reasons we chose it. Because we knew we were coming to London for the Target Exhibition, we're going to record an episode. And we thought, let's do like a little Doctor Who pub crawl.
Yes.
go to the haunts of Tom Baker.
Wow. And the correct ones. Not the Coach and Horses on Wellington Street.
Which we did, almost did.
Which we went to.
Which actually, you know, we could have got away with that, but it was equally as busy.
Yeah, we were in the proper environment. Because when we went in, a guy who looks like a kind of alcoholic poet painter.
He was getting a lot of photos taken, wasn't he? Yeah.
I mean, because the Coach and Horses is still the place where the guys at Private Eye, where the staff and writers of the satirical British newspaper Private Eye still hang out there. Mm-hmm. It's still quite a bit of a Soho haunt, though Soho is in London, nowhere near the haunt of artists and gangsters that it once was in the 1970s and 60s.
More is the pity.
I don't know, I feel the same way about Robot that I feel the same way about The Next Doctor.
Well, me too, I love it. It's
just a laugh.
It's
just a laugh.
And actually, I've never really noticed before just how great the script is. Like, in terms of dialogue. I just think it's really funny. You know?
Sure.
And I don't know if that's just maybe just, like, very assured hands like Tom Baker, Nick Courtney, and Liz Sladen working with it.
I mean, it looks like what it is. Which is Terence Dix has. He knows exactly how to craft and pace and write a story.
Yes.
And as the outgoing script editor, this has taken him no time at all.
Yeah, true. But there is some really properly funny moments in it. And actually, it's funny trying to get my head around.
Like what? What's your favourite?
My favourite, and it's a really old pat gag. But it's where the doctor said, you need some sort of... And then Sarah walks in and goes, 7-foot robot with a good... Well, exactly. And that's such an old Pat joke.
Yeah.
But it just really works. And I think it's just the way it's directed, the timing, just the performances from Tom Baker and Liz Sladen, that it just makes me laugh out loud, like, each and every time. I just think it's so funny.
Maybe not laugh out loud, but I do love the unsinkable exchange between him and Harry.
Yeah.
I like that bit. I don't know. I really like the Doctor trying to stall for time in front of Think Tank.
Yeah.
And basically, like, properly hyping up the Harpo Marx element of his character.
And I think what's really actually great is that all the way through, because this is, like, I don't know, God knows how many times I've watched Robot.
Yeah.
But this was the first time I actually tried to properly contextualise it in my head. So kind of like, well, what's gone before? You've had Pertwee for 5 years?
Yeah.
You know, and he's kind of this kind of...
Well, five seasons rather than years.
Yeah, so this kind of stiff sort of anti-authority figure, but also kind of establishment-y in a way.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, like, contemporarily, John Pertwee's Doctor is more like the Saint or Jason King or John Steed.
Yeah.
It's a twinkle of anti-establishment in the eye. But really,
he's a government man.
You can totally tell that, like, if he wasn't an alien, you know, like, he probably went to the Oxbridge of Gallifrey or something.
Yeah,
like that,
yes. And then to watch almost immediately Tom Baker feels like a complete breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Like, it was so different.
Like, there's a bit where he's in the Jeep and he's just got his feet up. And, like, a really awkward, like, that does not look comfortable.
Yeah.
But he's got his feet up against the steering wheel.
Yeah.
And you're like, you just couldn't imagine John Pertwee doing that. You couldn't imagine John Pertwee, like, bustling into the Think Tank meeting and getting on stage and doing gags and card tricks and all that kind of thing.
Pertwee was never really good at, which is bizarre for being a comic, but he was never one for business. He was never one for, if he was talking, doing anything else.
Yes.
Distracting from his face giving the performance.
Yes, that's true, but I think maybe that comes from...
There's a lot of Tom Baker in this. He is reclining. He has his hat over his eyes.
He's always, like, lying down or...
He looks like, really the only time you get to see properly his face is when he's looking in the mirror in that regeneration scene with Harry Sullivan.
Yeah.
You get a proper look at him as the Doctor. The rest of the time he's kind of concealing himself.
Yeah, either under the hat or... I think it's one of the most assured debuts there is. He just seems to just...
character.
Just inhabit the role. I mean, obviously, the way that he plays that role will change over the 7 years. But it's the first kind of... Certainly, you get the first inklings of that kind of Sherlock Holmes in space portrayal that he had kind of up to Talons, and then it kind of shifts with the change of the production team. Where basically they kind of lose a bit of control over him and he kind of becomes more Tom Baker than the Doctor.
Yeah.
This is very much at the stage where he's playing a role.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he looks like kind of like what I suppose he is, which is a man who was working as a... He was an actor, but he's working as a labourer.
Yeah.
And then suddenly gets his absolute gift. His absolute gift of an acting part.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to throw everything at the wall to make sure that this works for him.
Uh-huh.
Which you kind of at the end, this is what I kind of feel that if you look at the end, after they've killed quite brutally the giant robot, the Doctor is far too happy and triumphant when Harry drives Bessie back to the unit troops.
He's got a bucket.
And you think, the Doctor shouldn't be so joyous to have dispatched something that, like, at the very, very least, mattered to Sarah. Because Sarah's probably gutted at the end of that episode. And I do wonder if that's less the Doctor and more Tom Baker as the actor looking absolutely overjoyed that he's completed his first mission as the Doctor.
Perhaps.
And he's like going, there, I can do it. He's telling friends, I can do it. He's telling himself, I can do this. I can see.
There is a sort of celebratory which seems slightly tonally off.
Well, there's nowhere you could end that with people looking sad and glum and navel gazing. Ham-fisted profundity, you know.
You know, he was an intelligent being, and you know, so at the end of the day.
Anyway, shut up, you want a jelly, baby?
Yeah. He did stomp on a guy. Yeah. And there's a bit where, I've forgotten it. There's a bit where like he kind of picks up like an Action Man doll and drops it.
Yeah, they don't close in on it, but there's a bit where he's fighting the unit troops.
He just like drops this guy from a great height.
There's two of them, there's one in each flimsy claw, and he lobs these two dolls.
So I mean, you know, he's not blameless.
No, he's not. But it's because his program has been tampered with. I think there's some credit for Michael Kilgariff.
You
honestly do feel for that robot.
You do. You very much do.
You know, in a way, you don't bizarrely for the cyber controller.
I think it's a really great debut for Tom Baker as the Doctor, and also just and for Ian Martyr as Harry Sullivan. I think that.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
I think he's really strained in this.
No, I think
not the performance. I think the performance is great when he gets to give one. I think they find increasingly strained ways of making sure Harry is. There's a bit in episode 4 where the Doctor is going to launch off to try and find the metal virus.
Yeah.
And the Brigadier just looks at Harry and goes, I guess you better go with him.
Which is,
you could probably go, well, you know, he's probably still, the Doctor's still a bit ill. He needs his doctor monitoring. But it's actually, another way of just going, you go with him, so you're part of the action.
But do you know what that is and why it's so refreshing to see? And actually, it's one of the reasons I really love Robot, especially now.
Yeah.
Is that this is as much. And actually, I think really for the only time since the Time Warrior, maybe Planet of the Spiders, where it is as much a story about Sarah Jane.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, one of the notes I've got here is nice to see the original pilot for the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Absolutely.
It's in episode 1, 2, and basically number 3 as well.
Yeah. She's
driving
the action.
Everything happens because of her, yeah.
It's like, you know, basically what happens is the Doctor's kind of sidelined.
Yeah.
So Sarah's like, oh, well, you're convalescent. I'll just do a bit of work for the magazine.
Yeah.
And she goes off and gets involved in this plot.
Yeah.
And then the Doctor's like, oh, well, I suppose I better wade in and try and help where I can.
Yeah.
And that obviously comes from like a very functional perspective of like, well, this is the character you know.
Yeah.
We've changed the central character. So we'll focus on her quite a lot as you're getting to know this other guy. But actually, it's really great. It's so much fun to just watch Sarah Jane as the protagonist of the programme.
Yeah.
And it's something that the classic series does so rarely.
Yeah.
And you know, with the support
really
characters.
This, Planet of the Spiders and this, where she is going undercover to research a story.
Yeah.
So it's the only thing you really see her being a journalist.
Yeah.
Even in the Sarah Jane Adventures, how often do you really see her
the journalist thing,
investigating anything for money or sitting down and physically writing something at a computer, at a typewriter? How often do you see that?
Oh, God. While we're on that subject, have you seen K1 and Company?
No, what's that?
So if somebody's done a YouTube spoof, we'll post a link up on the website, where they've re-edited the titles to K9 and Company, but with clips from Robot.
Yeah.
So it's the giant... It's basically posing the idea of Sarah Jane and the giant robot in a spin-off series together.
That'd be amazing.
And it is so funny. It's so, so funny.
Less amazing would be K7 and Company, where Sarah Jane and an empty fluid link have adventures.
Would it just be around her neck?
Just be like a little souvenir.
But anyway, but the Sarah Jane adventures, they use the journalism thing as a cover.
Yeah.
She, like, she knows something's up and she just goes in pretending to be a journalist.
Yeah. In exactly the same way that we met her in the Time Warriors.
And that's fine, that's good. But yeah, I really like, I think that is one of the things I really love about Robot, is that it's as much a story about Sarah Jane Smith than it is about a doctor. And it is rare you get that. It really is.
There are other bits as well. I like the way that they reward characters. Like, some of the best Benton moments are in Robot.
First
he gets a promotion.
Yeah.
He's a warrant officer now.
Which Sarah doesn't really care. Like, all right,
yeah, well, they got to promote him once more again in the Android Invasion. And then we really start taking notice. But I absolutely love the scene in episode 4 where Benton tells the Doctor about the metal virus.
Yeah.
And they buzz off, and Benton's standing there beaming. And then he gets like a shot looked at by the Brigadier, and then he stops and gets back to attention.
That is amazing.
But the fact that Benton is the person who provides the answer.
Yeah.
Who has such a, like,
and the Doctor's reaction to that is so, like, it's that great Tom Baker thing of like a big grin, the shaking of the hand, the pattern of it. It's really lovely to see.
Yeah. It kind of looks like in two different faces. So, I mean, so John Levine's always said that, like, his mentor was John Pertwee.
Yes.
So it almost looks like we're getting to see on screen, but with a different Doctor.
Because you imagine that if he'd done that to Pertwee, the third Doctor would have been like, well, why didn't you fucking tell me that earlier?
Yeah.
You're panning around with it. You should have. What, did you not mention this before?
Yeah, well, you just.
Oh,
yeah.
God's sake. And also, actually, it's quite weird.
Maybe not. I mean, the third Doctor's not necessarily a huffy teenager.
He is a bit. I mean, I love the third Doctor. But there's a bit of that kind of, that sort of bumbling, well, not bumbling, sorry, that kind of blustering kind of, oh!
Yeah.
You people are idiots.
Everybody is holding him back for some reason.
And also, that's why it's so weird to see the fourth Doctor in a lab working on a thing.
Yeah.
It was only really this time watching that I was like, such an odd thing to see. Because he kind of just sits down and he's kind of just working with things.
Yeah.
And he's been a bit short with the Brigadier via the radio, which is funny. But it feels like a bird we see.
Yeah.
Which is, I suppose, fair enough because, you know, you're still kind of easing people out into this new direction the show's going to take.
But yeah, I mean, like, the whole thing looks like a Pertwee adventure. Actually, does it though? I thought if this looks like anything, this looks like a Sylvester McCoy story.
Well, that's interesting. Okay.
Now that might just purely be superficial, down to the fact that they've got the outside broadcasting rather than location stuff is shot on film.
Yeah.
But there was just something about.
Yeah, because there was another strike or something, wasn't there?
Yeah. No, it wasn't. So the reason they did the outside broadcast.
No, sorry, I mixed it up. There was a strike when Blue Peter were filming.
Right. Okay.
And they had to record an episode on the set of Robot.
That's why
the confusion
was. Because it's on the Spiders DVD. So the reason they had the outside broadcasting is because it would be easier to mix in CSO of the robot.
Of course, right.
Because apparently everyone had looked at the CSO and film mixture on Invasion of the Dinosaurs and went, this doesn't all match up.
Yeah, right.
So they went, right, we'll just make it easy. And then they went back to film again for Sontaran Experiment. No, they didn't.
No, they
Genesis.
Yeah,
right?
Somebody else said broadcast.
Well, they're back from Genesis.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know if it's that, but there's just something about it that makes me think of more like an 80s adventure rather than a 70s.
Well, just in terms of its kind of filmic style rather than its story or.
No, like that kind of. I don't know. I just pictured Sylvester McCoy in Tom Baker's role.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's because of the sometimes over-the-top comedic elements. I don't know.
Well, I suppose the card tricks on stage is very great to show in the galaxy.
Yeah. And I am particularly thinking of that era.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, survival or anything. I don't know. Maybe what we're actually saying is that it's unlike any adventure we've ever seen before. There's this idea it's like a Pertwee story.
Well, that's the thing. Everybody goes,
on the set of the Pertwee story.
Yeah. Everybody goes, oh, you know, it's like a Pertwee story. And I said, yeah, but is it? Because I don't think. I mean, yeah, fine. So there's a situation happening on Earth that you didn't get involved in, and the Doctor helps out. But like you said before, it's like a pilot. It's like an early pilot for the Sarah Jane Adventures. It feels a lot more like that kind of like one of those episodes of the Sarah Jane Adventures where the Doctor just turns up as part of the action.
Yeah. Because he's not just convalescing from his regeneration. There's a bit where he gets like at the end of episode 2 when he gets knocked unconscious by the robot.
Yeah,
he's
again.
He's knocked out for that for a bit of time. So you get the whole Sarah going along with Kettlewell to the SRS,
which is a mistake.
But the fact that she's like the fact that now she knows the danger and she's still motivating.
Yeah, because that is Sarah Jane Smith. That is the best of that character. I suppose it's kind of an advantage. It's the next step from Jo Grant is that Jo Grant will get herself into trouble because she thinks she's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Sarah Jane Smith will get herself into trouble because she knows she's doing the right thing.
Sarah's great. And as I said, Benton, less so the Brigadier.
Funny. Nick Courtney is. I mean, we're all both on record as I'd really loving Nick Courtney.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite bits in this is towards the start where they're talking about who is it they're talking about now, and the Brigadier says, "Oh well, I'm an old traditionalist or something like that."
Oh yeah.
And you're like, not with that haircut, you're not. That is not a regulation.
That's why Sarah Jane goes, "Oh, Brigadier, you're a swinger." Just to throw away
line. He's got this kind of big sort of mop of hair and his sideburns.
Yeah. But there's something about Courtney's performance in this. Now, either he's playing the Brigadier as quite weary, or he himself knows that the writing is on the wall for UNIT as regularly.
I think that, because I know a lot of people point to Seeds of Doom.
Yeah.
Yes, Seeds of Doom. I always get those two mixed up. It's the Seeds of Death as the Ice Wars one, Seeds of Doom is the.
Seeds of Doom is the resprayed axons.
They point to that as the last UNIT story.
Yeah. It's not really, because nobody's in it.
I see with the Android Invasion, I don't really see that as a UNIT story. I see that as a story where UNIT turn up.
Yeah.
Like, in.
The last UNIT story.
Like, Aliens Among Dinners.
Is Terror of Zygons, I think.
Even then, I feel that, like, Terror of the Zygons is that the Doctor's called into something and he turns up.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like a UNIT story, it feels like a Doctor Who story where UNIT are there helping out. Because, for me, a UNIT story, the way a UNIT story works is that basically.
The regular.
Yeah. The Doctor is in his laboratory, the Brigadier knocks on the door, comes in and goes, "Something's happening out in this, Blake, you've got to come in and give us a hand." And he goes, "Alright, cool, let's go." And he drives off with Bessie, and there's all that. I think there's certain aspects of a UNIT story, and it's basically, it's the Pertwee era.
Yeah.
This is the last story that feels a bit like the Pertwee era, but it's still moving off in a new direction, because you've got a completely different Doctor.
Yeah.
He's so different from Doctor. That's why I'm like, God, like, how different must this have seemed at the time for people watching? Did they immediately gravitate towards this as an exciting thing, or did they go, oh this isn't? And also, I mean, I think you look at the Russell T. Davies era.
Yeah.
Because look, let's try and connect it. Because we always say, oh yeah, we're trying to connect the two, the new stories or the classic story.
Yeah.
We never really do we kind of talk about them in separate. But the Pertwee era is the obvious influence on Russell T. Davies as Doctor Who.
Do you think so?
I think so, because certainly on the first couple of series, because you've got that kind of that family back home, and there's events that take place within a contemporary setting that you have these supporting characters that are also influenced by the story, and then they will go off because it gets boring to kind of stay in one setting.
Yeah, you never get a sense there's going to be a prolonged period away.
No, you always feel they're going to come back, and you always get that with the Pertwee era.
Yeah.
Whereas this, like you say, because it's a new production team, and because Robert Holmes and Philip Hitchcliffe want to bring it back to that kind of thing where it's like the 60s, where the Doctor goes off to a new place every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And there's nothing really to bring him back home.
Yeah. But I mean, they even do that very. It's genuinely amazing how tentatively this is done.
But that's because it's been 5 years.
From the off, Barry Letts and Terence Dix said that they wanted to get the Doctor back out into space again.
But they never really.
They very tentatively do it every now and again, even when they give the Doctor back his
dematerialization
he still pops back. All of this is seen as little trips, and then when you actually get a new Doctor, you have a series of very closely linked adventures, so never at any point do you think Sontaran is starting space and Sontaran and Genesis and the Revenge of the Cybermen, all of which happen so continuously you never get a chance to go, why aren't you going home?
And then even does Revenge of the Cybermen not end with the Doctor getting the signal from the Brigadier?
Yeah, and then they show back up in Terror of the Zygons.
So that whole first series like a little thread.
That whole first series is a short trip. So you don't actually get to see them properly going back into space again.
But arguably, that's not necessarily going back to the Pertwee model. That's not necessarily sticking with the Pertwee model. That's sticking with the 60s model. The Hartnell model of that kind of the end of the story will lead into the next story.
Sure.
The
feeling was that the Pertwee years were so important and familiar and all this
accomplished.
They honestly had to take a couple of years to very gently break with that tradition, break with that familiar environment. And even then, Terror of the Zygons and then Android Invasion. Okay, it doesn't have the
British deal. That's only 4 weeks later or something, so you've got Terror of the Zygons, there's another story, and then maybe there are two stories.
But, either way, so Harry Sullivan and Sergeant Benton, Regimental Sergeant Major Benton.
Yes.
And then you're right, they do have unit again in the Seeds of Doom. Nobody we know, but it's
just some soldiers turn up.
It's still that familiar idea of the Doctor with that kind of buried fighting force.
But I think when you've had, because let's not forget, like Nick Courtney, John Levine, Richard Franklin, and then Katie Manningham and Liz Sladen. They're like such a that is 5 years worth of a very strong team.
Yeah, absolutely.
That will take a long time to get a shake off.
Yeah.
Even for a show that, as we keep saying, it's a bit of a cliche, it's about change, about renewal.
Yeah.
You've still been with these people for 5 years. That's a long time. It's not like, Fee Majumin being there for a year, Catherine Tate being there for the next year. And then you get rid of David Tennant and you get away with starting completely fresh because you've kind of earned the goodwill.
Yeah.
This is like we're going to need to just gradually move away from.
Yeah,
from
and it is incredibly gradual.
Yeah.
But it's earned.
Yes,
over the course of this,
absolutely.
And what we should say about context as well is that Robot is actually filmed as the last recording, but it's actually a lot of it was made concurrently with Planet of the Spiders.
Oh, right, okay, I didn't know that, but I knew it was.
Yeah, so I think I'm right in saying that there was a lot of stuff with Sarah Jane that was being filmed for Planet of the Spiders. She was then also filming for Robot as well.
Oh, okay.
And then there's the usual 3-4 month gap?
Yes.
And then they probably start production again, so probably Robert Holmes as producer. Sorry, Robert Holmes as script editor, Philip Hinchcliffe as producer.
With Ark and Space,
space. You know.
Yeah.
And that's when you genuinely... There is a tonal shift there.
Yes, there is. There absolutely is. Yeah. But I think, I mean... That's right, I'm going to consult my notes just... Because we're kind of... I think we're talking a lot about the contextualizers, which is fine and great. I mean, but should we talk about the?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So let's
move into the story itself
more specifically.
Because is it just me, or is everybody who builds a robot? Now, if you're going to create an artificial life form, that's fine. You know, great. Go ahead and do that. Do what you want. But like, they just seem to have Isaac Asimov's writing is just hardwired. He was just a science fiction author. He's not an authority. You don't have to.
No, but it's been taken
that
as the...
I find that really fascinating that has been taken as the kind of the laws of robotics.
Isn't it ever since they used it in Forbidden Planet, the film?
Quite possibly, yes.
Walter Pidgeon and Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah.
When Robbie the Robot starts reciting why and how and if and possibly about harming or not harming human beings. Because that was written by Asimov. Everybody's taken that.
Yeah. I mean, because that was all in all of Asimov. Fiction, you know, like iRobot is very much, it's a murder mystery, and it's about, well, you know, like, but wait, kind of like this, I guess. It's well, what? Well, if it's hardwired not to kill,
no mystery,
not to kill humans, then why is it killed a human?
Yeah.
Well, because somebody just changed the programming.
Yeah. Yes. Well, exactly.
I find that really funny. You know, like everything about you kind of think that the whole idea of robotics and stuff like that is a technological thing. But actually, I mean, in terms of fiction, it goes back to Isaac Asimov, and it's one of those weird cases of kind of science fiction kind of influencing science fact, I guess.
Yeah, or other fiction.
Yeah, or other, and obviously other fiction. Yeah.
It's a great looking robot.
I love it. I think
when it's not moving.
Yeah.
When it's not moving or holding anything.
It's got that problem that a lot of BBC props have, is that you go, well, that looks fucking amazing, but the problem is an actor has to work inside that, and then when it does, it looks a bit ropey.
Yeah. My favourite goofs, like, say, when they're leaving the SRS meeting hall, and it looks so, the actor Alec Lindstedt plays Jellicoe, looks like he's hiding from unit troops firing at the robot, behind the robot. But what he's actually doing is helping Michael Kilgariff drift this robot down the steps and then into the back of the truck. Like, so he's actually... So from, you know, like, favourite performance. Effortlessly lending aid to your actor by looking like you're working against that actor. 100% is the guy playing Jellicoe.
One of my two of my favourite goofs is this. While we're on the subject, involves people being hit in the arm. So there's a bit in which Harry and Sarah are in the cell, and the robot is in the cell with them. And I think it's Jellicoe himself. He sort of swings open the door of the cell, and it clatters into the arm of the robot, really loudly.
Yeah.
And then also, like, a few.
And then the robot looks really surprised.
Yes. Yeah,
what the hell are you doing, man? What are you doing?
And then later on, like, I think it's about 5 minutes later, like, it's when the robot bursts out and they all retreat, and the doctor's like in the jeep, and this soldier clambers in the jeep behind him and like boots Tom Baker in the arm.
Yes,
I love it. I love just noticing all these little silly human touches that, you know, in Doctor Who.
Yeah. Or when the unit soldiers are running away from the robot, and like the last unit soldier right in the center of the frame, like, slips up as he's running up the grassy hill. Here's an interesting factoid for you. So, you know, so Alec Lindstedt plays Jellicoe.
Yes.
Originally, Christopher Barry, the director, wanted to cast Colin Baker in that role.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Because apparently Colin Baker was at this point sharing a house with Christopher Barry. He's either brother or son.
Right, okay.
At drama school or something like that. Well, tell you what, in terms of casting, let's talk about this. Alternative fourth doctors.
Oh, of course, yes. Because obviously, one of the reasons we have Ian Martin younger.
Yeah.
As Harry Sullivan, as they thought they were going to be going older.
Yeah.
And they wanted to return to that kind of.
So he was going to be the Ian Chesterton or Stephen Taylor.
And what I love about, I think it's maybe more in the performance than in the writing. But when you realise that Tom Baker's actually a younger man, and Harry Sullivan's kind of, you don't need to have the accent man thing, that what I really love about Ian Martyr's portrayal is that he often seems surprised when he has to punch a guy in the face. How good he is at it.
Yeah.
When he punches Jericho in the bunker, like the look on Ian Martyr's face is proper, kind of just like, I can do that. Cool. My favourite thing is just the absolute glee he takes in being able to go undercover. I can wear a disguise.
And he properly goes full on John Steed when he's supposed to go undercover.
He's the bowler hat and the umbrella and
the pinstripe suit and shirt.
I think, we were talking about meta with the next Doctor. I was like, I remember watching that this time and going, is that just an overt reference to the Avengers? Because the way he kind of takes the hat off. It is very Patrick McNeigh.
I mean, again, I'll say he doesn't get much to do with this. It's quite strange, but I love Harry Sullivan. Absolutely. Which is why I got quite upset with his Zygon invasion, Zygon Empire.
But there's that thing that Stephen Moffat said about it. You give Peter Capaldi like a slightly insulting line, and it's like a javelin. And I think that's written as it's supposed to be like an affectionate.
On the way to this wonderful Doctor Who day, and we don't often call out other Doctor Who podcasts.
We don't, but we're not as popular.
I don't care to network. I mean, if I want to genuinely share stuff with people, if it's worth doing so. But I was listening to the Blue. Not Blue Box.
Who are also very good.
Radio Free Scar. They had an interview with Peter Harness. And the problem I have is the idea that Harry Sullivan became some sort of genetic warfare
expert.
Down. Like he was creating like gases to kill alien menaces, presumably the Zygons. I felt uncomfortable like that. What Peter Harness was saying is that line has been taken far too literally. And it was apparently just supposed to be one of the smokescreen elements that the Doctor and Harry had created. There was never any intense
biological.
There was never any biological warfare. It always came down to this.
I suppose that works because that's the whole idea, isn't it? It's contained within the box or something. The box is just a complete lie.
The box is empty. It's just a way of getting people to talk around a table. So there's no Sullivan's gas. The writer himself, Peter Harness, has said, and you should listen to the Radio Free Scaro. I can't remember which. It's the May edition, so pretty recently. That made me feel a lot better.
That works.
By Harry Sullivan.
That works. I mean, I think that's one of the things about modern Doctor Who is that sometimes, because Doctor Who's always been a show where the ideas are so big that it's not always contained either budgetary-wise or whatever. And I think nowadays, although the budget's very much kind of better, I think the time isn't always there to kind of properly cover everything that they want to do, and that's why you suggest at the start of that two-part that Harry Sullivan has invented this gas that can turn a Zygon and said, which is a horrible idea. That actually, by the time it comes to the second episode, where there's this whole amazing scene where there's these people around the table and they're talking about the sort of the nature of war and about how eventually people have to sit down and talk, that you kind of, because I think it's actually also partially due to the fact that that scene is so captivating, that you kind of then forget the reason. Like he says, is that actually there was never any gas inside that box. Those are two just empty boxes that don't do anything.
Well, what he said was you could see it that there wasn't a gas. So he's not necessarily saying there definitely wasn't. But he said in his head that there wasn't a gas.
Gas didn't exist.
I mean, one of my favourite Sarah Jane moments is when they both get locked up and she just goes, James Bond.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's great.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, like, she's right. I mean, if you're going to phone, if you're going to blow your cover and phone your covert organisation, don't use a public payphone in the corridor of the organisation that you're undercover in order to apprise them of what's going on.
What's the officer's line where, I think the Brigadier says something like, oh, the line's broken up.
No, he says and broken connection or broken head.
Yeah.
Or broken head, because they found out what he's up to.
I love that. But that's the thing, what I say about the script, is that I think there's just so many really wonderful lines in it.
Yeah.
That I think then come to define the Tom Baker.
Yeah.
It's just this like really sharp dialogue that you sometimes get.
I genuinely think the attitude behind Robot is because at no point do you genuinely actually give a shit about or believe that there's nuclear weapons poised all around the world.
No.
To be set off on like a bunker.
Oh God, right, don't even get me started on that.
It's just so jolly and happy.
Obviously, I text you on Saturday night.
Yeah.
This is Monday.
Yeah.
And just saying, you know, can I just say I'm very much looking forward to talking about these two stories because they're just two just ones that I just really adore.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily my favourite Doctor Who's of all time, but they're certainly Doctor Who's that I will watch and just feel nothing but joy towards.
The attitude and the motivation behind them
is
hard to fault.
But and you texted me that and said, oh, I'm finding it quite hard to come up with anything negative to say.
Yeah.
Not
that that's what we try and do.
No. But you kind of want to give a balanced view.
Yeah.
Now, the very idea that to avert a World War III, that all of the main nuclear countries basically write out their launch codes and give them to a neutral power and then lock them inside their safe. Oh, I can't see that going wrong at all.
Well, I also don't understand why of the three nuclear powers, two being communist, they would happily give their
to Britain.
Yeah. Is this something odd that happened from the Doctor being polite to the Chinese and the mind of evil?
Maybe that's what it is. But that being said,
that is a great line though as well. Because of course the rest are foreigners, obviously.
Because he's just about to go, well, yeah, and then he goes.
Yeah.
I love that. But as a plot device, it's bonkers. It's bonkers.
Because it doesn't matter. It's just about Doctor Who and a giant robot.
Yes.
So obviously we've got Miss Hartigan as the female protagonist in Next Doctor, and we've been over the reason, but we also have Miss Patricia Maynard as Hilda Winters, the head of think tank and the scientific
the Scientific Reform Society.
She's not as nuanced as Miss Hartigan.
No. She's one of these stock Doctor Who characters who wants, you know, like Invasion of the Dinosaurs.
Sure.
They want to create a better world.
By a simpler world.
Getting rid of the one that currently exists. So there's no real kind of insight into their motivations. And even Kettlewell doesn't really get it. It's just that he kind of wanted that.
Well, he's just a chump that's been he's very gullible and he's been taken the land of, you know.
Yeah. So it's perhaps not developed as well as it could be.
Yeah.
But again, you kind of don't really care.
Well, yeah, I mean, for instance,
I mean, I love the scenes between her and Sarah. I think they're really good.
Her and Sarah and doing my favourite scene now, I think my favourite scene is probably in episode 2 when the Doctor and the Brigadier show up to investigate Think Tank. And so it's the Doctor, really is the Doctor becoming that fourth Doctor with Miss Winters. There is great chemistry.
Yes, there is.
You could only launch a new Doctor after John Pertwee by being 100% different. But you know, what would it genuinely have been like? We've got the hindsight that he is the definitive image of Doctor Who.
Exactly.
That's what
we meant to talk about that in 10-15 minutes.
We're talking about casting. So who could we have had? Well, first and foremost, we could have had Bernard Cribbins.
Could we? I've never heard that before.
Yes. A few of the sources.
nonsense that I've been reading, Bernard Cribbins.
Okay.
Not, I don't think, as seriously as, say, others like Graham Crowden.
Yes, and you remember
or
him.
Or Fulton Mackay.
Oh, I thought he was going to be the third Doctor. Was it the fourth Doctor?
No, Fulton Mackay. I think he wanted
to. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, I think it would have been really interesting as well. I love Fulton Mackay. What really tickles me is that Michael Bentine, the original fourth member of the Goon Show, could have been the Doctor. But apparently, he was saying, "Yeah, I'll do it." Yeah. But he wanted to be able to write scripts as well. He wanted a script,
yeah, sure,
which would have been undesirable, according to Barry Letts. That was the word he used. Undesirable. Who else was there? There was
also that. This is probably the one you're thinking of. And actually, no, you're right. I was right. Richard Hearn was offered the role.
Richard Hearn, right? Okay, this
but
was
his assistant. He wanted to play the role in the style of Mr. Pastry.
Right, okay.
Which
right.
Like,
no, you're not doing that.
But also considered was Jim Dale.
Jim Dale, of course. Carry-on star Jim Dale. So, who would have been at the time younger than Tom Baker?
I believe so, yeah.
So it can't have been a genuine consideration if they were still looking to cast a younger, stronger man.
Well, I think Richard Hearn was the one that was definitely offered the role.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, why you get Ian Barker, because I think Richard Hearn was a bit older than Tom Baker.
But I mean, they were also in a Fulton Mackay, older Graham Crowden.
But yeah, I think you can never tell what would happen.
Yes. What if? Well, yeah. You know, I mean,
favorite scenes, favorite parts.
Yeah, let's start with the end. Right. Well, I mean, I think I've already said my favorite scene,
okay,
which is when the Doctor and the Brigadier in episode 2 show up.
Yeah, that is
Pink
good.
Time. And he's got this barely, Tom Baker's got this barely concealed, he's all but saying, "I think you're liars."
Yeah.
Oh, well, Brigadier, I think it would be very hard for you to get permission to search our premises, but why don't you go ahead? Well, then I'm quite sure we needn't bother. Good day.
That's good.
I love that.
I have a couple of favourite scenes. My first one is, it's a bit silly, but it's the bit where the Doctor is in the laboratory towards the end of part 4. Of course, for best Eden's complex.
Yes.
And the Brigadier, the thing that really sells it to me, and then the Brigadier goes, "Oedipus, Doctor, I don't think that..." Because I love the idea that the Brigadier is well-versed in psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
And is just like dismissing the Doctor's analysis of the robot psyche, like, out of hand. What? No, of course not. He does not need psychoanalysis. He needs cognitive behavioural therapy.
Yeah.
And I think that this is...
I love that. Again, it goes back to, I don't know what Nicholas Courtney is necessarily doing, but there's a great kind of, so he dismisses that.
Yeah.
And I think he dismisses it just because it sounds like bullshit.
Yeah, no. But I love the idea that he dismisses it because he's aware of what the Oedipus theory is.
Yeah.
The Oedipus complex is, and goes,
no,
doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
I love when he says, "For once, can I just meet an alien who's not impervious to bullets?"
Yeah.
Or there's this weird moment where Sarah goes missing, and Benin's reporting that, well, we thought she just went home.
Yeah.
And there's something like that. I can't remember what the Doctor says, and he went, and the Brigadier's reaction to those situations just, like, again, like, oh, another thing.
Yeah.
Come on.
I love the Brigadier, like, because I think...
He just harumphs.
Because, and we'll talk about this in more detail when we come to the end of time, but I think the idea that the Doctor is never really in danger because he can always regenerate.
Yeah.
I think that's born from the end of Planet of the Spiders, the start of Robot.
Yeah.
Where the Brigadier goes, well, here we go again. And then it's given this kind of, it's a new guy.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's kind of how a human being would look at it, I guess. You know,
well, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, I mean, you would get, I mean, the whole arc, or a lot of the arc with Clara and the 11th Doctor, was all about being, she perfectly understood the situation, but she really, really wanted that single image of the Doctor.
Yes.
So, but presumably the nonchalance the characters have is about accepting that Doctor for the audience's sake.
Yes, yes.
Whereas you kind of think that maybe there should have been a moment where Benton and the Brigadier should have gone...
Or at least, one of the characters at least goes...
We missed that old white bouffant that you had. Can you not do that again?
Yeah.
But performance-wise,
oh, sorry, I wanted to just say one more favourite scene. Is the end. I mean, I know you were like, yeah, but like, what you've done is you've murdered that robot.
Yeah.
And of course she's going to be. But what I love is that I think the doctor offering the jelly baby. Yeah. And I love that this is the first instance of that, you know, well-worn catchphrase. Is that essentially, I think he realises what he's done.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, he doesn't quite know how to. And so he sort of pulls out this bag of sweets from his pocket. Would you like a jelly baby? And it's that tentative thing. And the jelly baby comes to represent, you know, do you want to keep this up?
It's like handing the key in the mouth of the companions in the modern.
And it's
scene.
Such a really beautiful, beautifully played scene. That would not be out of place in the modern series. You know, this whole idea that, oh, the classic series doesn't do emotion, the classic series doesn't do character development. I think that scene just completely shoots that down.
It does it far more quietly and subtly.
There's no sort of like sweeping string quartet or, you know, it's just the doctor handing over the paper bag and his friend takes a jelly baby and they go off in the TARDIS and they bring along Harry Sullivan.
But then that's great. I mean, I absolutely love
it's great. It's
when
so
Harry
good.
Takes a bite of the jelly baby and the doctor grabs it back.
Brilliant. I really love that scene because that is kind of just setting out the next amazing period of Doctor.
Yeah, yeah. Performances. I'm going to be controversial.
Okay.
Tom Baker, it's his story. It's
obviously.
Great.
Yeah.
But I love as you say, that this is as much Elizabeth Sladen's.
Yeah.
I also love, and they're basically cameos, but I love John Levine and Benton.
Mm-hmm. John Levine's fair. I really like Michael Kilgareth.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You know, I mean, sometimes it's a bit hammy,
but
I think it's just the right side of.
I mean, presumably because another big thing about this is that he's supposed to be King Kong.
Yes.
They do try and make him go all out, kind of 1930s RKO, melodrama, you know. I mean, it's properly. I mean, Christopher Barry even does, when they're in episode 4, when the robot is coming out, or episode 3, when the robot is coming out of the doors of the bunker, it's properly King Kong.
Yeah, it's the opening the cage thing. The only thing you can fault, because I suppose we can't talk about robots without talking about the tank.
Oh, the tank.
Now, if you follow us on Facebook or Twitter, you will have seen the photos that we've taken today.
Yeah.
And the one in which I tried to make Tom Baker look like he was standing next to Ben instead of the coach and horses. It's hard. But at least I tried. I think at least I tried. And at least I think I did it a lot better than what they did in Robot. Where essentially what they did was they just went, right, go and just put like a toy tank just like on this hill, this little bit of this mound of grass.
Yeah.
It's like, at least go a couple of miles back.
Do you know what actually I think the problem there is? And I was watching this with my girlfriend and I showed her that scene. And I think she was the one who pinpointed it correctly. Which is, it's not necessarily the perspective shot which is the fault.
Right.
It's the model itself which gives it away.
It does look very tacky.
If they'd just gone for a more detailed model, nobody would have been bothered by it. Because the actual shots themselves are perfectly timed. Right? You really don't, like, you're too busy looking at the various elements to really take in the whole. If they'd just gotten something, like a model that looked more like an actual tank, actually, you know, like more, like just stuff to look at, more stuff coming around, because it's rather smooth.
It's plastic.
It looks like if they'd gotten like a, I don't know, like one of those probably like bigger radio controlled type of model tank things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there.
I don't think anyone would have had a problem with it. I think it's not the shop, it's the model, the physical model they used. And I mean, also, okay, we haven't said it. It seems like it. Probably have to say the CSO is ropey, but I don't care.
I don't really care.
I don't really care about the tiny little not Sarah doll.
Yeah, the bit of dangly legs.
I get what they're trying to achieve,
is,
and mostly they do.
They do, and I mean, I think Robot. Watch it again. You know, if you listen to this, watch it again because there's so much to enjoy.
It's a bright breezy. You've got a bit of a threat. There's a bit of a tense moment. But at the end of it, it's funny and happy, and it sets up.
another amazing doctor. New era.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and with a genuine conviction.
Yeah.
Not like the Five Doctors, which is... I'm not going
to
let this...
I want this to be a running joke. I want this to be a running joke where you just, at the end of every episode, go, unlike the Five Doctors. Anyway, next time on the Time Lapse.
Yes, let's start bringing it in. I appreciate it. Thank you, listeners. And thank you for... Usually we record this in a white atmosphere.
Yeah.
This has been quite a noisy pub anyway.
It's going to be difficult to get a match up there.
You know, we will also listen to it for this back, and if this is an experiment that works, we'll do it again. If it's not, then we'll just
do it at your house.
Right about people's houses.
Because actually, I think it's cheaper to get to your house than it is to get to the Central London for me. But anyway, that's
I'm paying for numerous amounts of drinks.
Yes, well, there's that as well.
Right, well, we are now off back to the Coach and Horses to have a legitimate drink
by ourselves without you guys listening in.
I don't know. Hope. Against hope that Jean Hurt or I don't know, maybe Pierre Capaldi will walk in and
he's on holiday.
He looks like the sort of person that would do that kind of thing. He looks like a man rich in nostalgia. But okay, so that's the
next time.
Robot, we're all done. Next time.
So we've got Planet of the Dead. And I think am I right in thinking, which means I now have to go on to Amazon
yes.
and buy it.
Oh no.
We're doing Planet of Fire?
I think we'd say Planet of Fire.
Because it's kind of like Doctor Who in an exotic holiday location, and does it really warrant the use of those locations?
I think that's what we were trying to do.
That was the plan.
So
Planet of the Dead, Planet of Fire,
yes.
2 weeks' time.
Guys, thank you very much for joining us. As always, if you want to get in contact with us, our email is on thetimelash@outlook.com. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. Our website, we probably need to spruce it up a little bit, but it's functional.
thetimelash.wordpress.com
to get all the 42 other normal podcasts and then maybe 20 odd sideways podcasts.
We did about there's a few.
Yeah, if you want to listen to our commentaries on series 8 and series 9.
I have to say, I think my favourite episode that we ever did is our Fringe episode.
Okay.
Where we talked to Katie Manning and Tommy Borkovy and we reviewed Deep Breath.
Yeah, it's a special
thing. If you've not listened to that, I think that's certainly my personal favorite.
Set aside 3.5 hours
of
life.
It's a bit long.
It is long.
But to be honest, if Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo can churn out 2 hours every week just talking about films and music and just general bollocks, then so can we.
Films and music. Like there's not 2 hours of stuff to say about films. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been wonderful.
They've got an hour's worth of that. I don't know.
If you're in London, do go and see the Target exhibition.
Yeah.
If you're not, enjoy
your life.
No, seek out the Target novelisations.
Yeah.
Do it that way. Do it, enjoy it. You know, these are the artworks that were the covers of really legitimate, wonderful and legitimate pieces of Doctor Who.
You know, this is how people experienced Doctor Who when it wasn't on the telly.
Yeah.
You know, well, it was on the telly, but it wasn't.
In a time like we cannot conceive of now.
Imagine that.
With repeats and Blu-rays and DVDs.
Finish.
My God, man, we are spoiled. Oh, yeah, we've no Doctor Who this year. We are spoiled.
I'm off to the Coach and Horses.
Let's go to the Coach and Horses.
We'll see you next week.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day. Later.